one for 9 weeks. That's Seether with Country Song on Nikki Six. It's time to pack up and head to another city. We'll be back next weekend with more of the biggest and badass rock songs in the universe, along with my six picks. Carrie?
Yes.
Let's get out of here.
Okay, let's end. Pack up for the tour bus again.
Let's go. See ya.
The sideshow is now over. Go ahead. Stick a golden fork in it. We're done. Tomorrow, score the ultimate ticket package, including Motley Crue this Wednesday at DTE. And for Mayhem Festival featuring Disturbed August 6th at DTE. Plus, one lucky winner will go backstage to meet Nikki Six in person. Motley to Mayhem Monday. Every hour tomorrow starting at 11 a.m. with Ann Carlini. From 101 WRIF. Everything that rocks.
Most WRIF contests are open to legal U.S. residents at least 18 years old. Winners may win only one contest every 30 days or every 6 months for prizes worth $600 or more. Employees and their family of Greater Media Detroit, its advertising agencies, and other radio stations in the metro area may not participate. No purchase necessary. Prizes are not transferable, and rules are subject to change at any time. Complete rules are available online at WRIF.com or at the WRIF studios during regular business hours.
Now.
101 WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit.
Welcome to WRIF's award-winning Night Call, Detroit's longest-running phone-in talk show with Peter Werby and Jolene Jordan. Peter and Jolene will be voicing their opinions, and they want to hear yours. Call them at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Now, here are Peter and Jolene.
Thank you very much. Welcome. Hey, Jolene, how are
Hello,
you tonight?
Peter. Excellent. Thank you.
Beautiful evening in the Motor City.
Sure is.
And we've got a talk show going. So if you'd like to join us, our number again, 313-298-WRIF. Jolene and I guess our announcer said that. We give our opinions, you give yours. And as we've been saying, 313-298-WRIF, what does that say about most cell phones now that don't have those numbers?
I know. It really is something that just dawned on me one day. I thought, you know, maybe that the WRIF saying that, or the call letters for any radio station really, is going to just be kind of a novelty, not a real useful thing anymore. Well, but it's 313-298-9743.
Which during normal business hours, or whatever you'd call them, in normal rocking hours.
Yeah.
That's the contest line.
Yes.
And of course, we like it because it gives the call letters and it's easy to remember.
Well, RIF listeners know the number by heart. They have it plugged in.
Do you remember Congressman Anthony Weiner?
I do. It was so yesterday, though.
Yeah.
Right? See you later, Weiner.
Yeah, man. He's going out with Monica Lewinsky.
No, in that imaginary world.
All right, hey, if you'd like to email us, it's easy. calltalkyes@yahoo.com. calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Short emails have a chance to be read on the air. Facebook friends wanted at facebook.com/nightcall. And dare I say this? Podcast available at noon on Monday. Sometimes we have problems. You know,
we figured out the problem.
I was just saying to who you will reach when you call 313-298-9743, Sarah and Athena, that what was I saying? Oh, yeah, it used to be easier. All you had was a microphone and some tape.
Right.
Now all this stuff
took a lot longer to put it together at the end.
Yeah, but nobody was searching through endless internet files to find
our little bitty show.
Well, of all the little factoids about the war, you can't even use a singular anymore. The U.S. wars, the most amazing thing I saw, I don't know why. I mean, you think about all the figures, the death, the destruction, the couple trillion dollars that's been wasted in two unnecessary wars. But how about this? This was from National Public Radio, which sometimes we call Nationalistic Pentagon Radio or what is it? Nationalist Puppet Radio.
Right.
I know all the liberals love NPR, and all the conservatives think, they want to get rid of it because they think it's this far-left network. In any event, the amount the U.S. military spends annually on air conditioning in Iraq and Afghanistan is none of you will possibly ever guess this figure.
I know, it's astounding.
Hit them with it.
I can't remember the exact.
Oh, you don't have it in front of you.
I don't have it.
$20.2 billion yearly.
Yearly, 20, okay. 20
wait a minute.
Billion.
You're going, wait a minute. Hey. Maybe we made a little mistake here. For air conditioning for U.S. military in these two war zones, Iraq and Afghanistan, it's more than NASA's budget. It's more than BP has paid so far for damages they caused during the Gulf oil spill. Yeah, but here's what Stephen Anderson has said. He is a retired brigadier general who served as General David Petraeus' chief logistics guy in Iraq. He says, when you consider the cost to deliver the fuel to some of the most isolated places in the world, escorting, command and control, medevac support, when you throw all that infrastructure in, we're talking over $20 billion. So this NPR.
Crazy.
Yeah. Why does it cost so much? To power an air conditioner at a remote outpost in landlocked Afghanistan, a gallon of fuel has to be shipped to Karachi, Pakistan. Pardon me. Then driven 800 miles over 18 days to Afghanistan on roads that are sometimes little more than improved goat trails. And you've got risks that are associated with moving the fuel almost every mile of the way. Can you read from right here while I cough?
Yeah. Still, let's see, where are you? More than 1,000 troops have died in fuel convoys. More than 1,000 troops, wow, which remain prime targets for attack. Freestanding tents equipped with air conditioners in 125-degree heat require a lot of fuel. You can only imagine. Anderson says by making those structures more efficient, the military could save lives and dollars.
Now, get this. I mean, you know, the pollen season is one of the worst in a long time.
It's hitting you hard.
Yeah, it is. It is indeed. But it,
it won't keep you down, though.
It won't. I can keep throwing stuff to you. So be ready. Don't.
Okay.
You know, if I start raving sometime I see you, you sit back. I mean, it's understandable.
Well, you know, you have a lot to say. I like to hear it, too.
Yeah, I know. But, okay. So here, air conditioners for tents in 125-degree heat. And the simple response, and an understandable one, is that our troops are over there in harm's way, and even those of us, now we're the vast majority of the American people, 76% of the people say we should not be fighting a war in Afghanistan, that we at least owe these men and women some comfort. They don't want to be hanging out in 125-degree heat like the people that live there.
Well, that's a good point.
In the meantime, though, people routinely in this country die during heat waves.
Yeah.
What was it like? There was some extraordinary death toll. I mean, somebody check me on this, because could it have been as much as a couple thousand in Chicago? I know it was at least in the hundreds. I don't want to exaggerate, but I mean, this is insane, and it's just an idea of where our money's going. In fact, now the newest recruits to the anti-war movement are the big city mayors. And when you get in this deal where everywhere from, you know, big cities, the suburbs around here to Hollywood, Florida, issuing layoff notices to police officers, Lansing, Michigan and New York are threatening to close fire stations, teachers getting pink slips in Philadelphia, schools in Montgomery, Alabama are being closed, pardon me, libraries open less, on and on and on and on like that. In fact, when we talk about the unemployment, there's been 446,000 local government. Wait a minute. This is wrong. Local government shed 28,000 jobs last month. That is correct. And have lost almost 500,000 jobs since employment peaked in September 2008. So, you know, there is such a revenue problem. It's not if you don't have enough money, you can't spend. But the money is all there. I mean, that's what's important to know.
It's just being thrown away. Well, and I'm not saying that, I'm not talking about the air conditioning specifically, but war in general.
Yeah. And, you know, people are still dying. Civilians are dying. American soldiers are dying. American soldiers are dying in Iraq. A couple just died today.
Yeah. And it was the worst month in Afghanistan last month in years.
Yeah. So when downturn-weary mayors from around the country gathered in Baltimore last Friday, last Friday, for the annual meeting of the United States Conference of Mayors, or maybe it was, let me see, what's the date here, June 17th, no, a week ago, they introduced a resolution calling for the speedy end of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and calling on Congress to use the $126 billion a year the wars cost for urgent domestic needs. Now, that's incredible. I mean, if you, you know, this is what you would expect out of what? I don't know. And these are Republican mayors. These are Democratic mayors. But all of these cities are struggling. And ultimately, that affects all of us. And this
is not. They finally woke up and realized what the problem was.
Interestingly, you know, someone who's listened to the show, they said, I shouldn't even say this on the air, but they said, you know, I don't find your show that interesting anymore. I went, whoa, why not, man? And they said, well, it used to be so confrontational. And you used to have all these people calling up and disagreeing with you, supporting the war.
It's not our fault people are coming around to our way of thinking.
I mean, against gay marriage, now the majority of people support gay marriage. Yeah. I'm trying to think what all the other issues are. I mean, legalization of marijuana, whatever.
Right, yeah. That's
The fact that we should say eat the rich, people say, oh, you know, it's their money. They earned it, you know.
Well, now people are feeling the pain. It's hitting their wallets.
Yeah, well, on a couple of days ago, on June 24th, the House of Representatives dealt at least a symbolic blow to Barack Obama, the president, by resoundingly failing to approve a bill authorizing the contentious military operations in Libya, which was so weird. So that, you know, under the War Powers Act, I mean, right now, President Obama is in violation of the War Powers Act. He's in violation of the U.S. Constitution. And all of these Republicans are whining, if this would have been President Bush, everybody would have. Well, you know what? I think that's true. I think that for one thing, the Republicans would have been defending him. But certainly, you know, the left and the Democrats and everybody like that would have really been hammering Bush. But the Democrats are holding back a little because it's their man, right? So, mm-hmm. Which I don't find defensible
that's
at all.
It's starting to turn more and more.
And what happened is two senators, John Kerry, Democrat of Massachusetts, and John McCain, Republican of Arizona, introduced a Senate measure which would have approved the military actions in Libya. But 70 Democrats joined Republicans in defeating this resolution, 295 to 123. The only Democrats in Michigan that voted essentially against giving Barack Obama the permission, President Obama, to continue the war in Libya were John Conyers and Hanson Clark of Detroit.
Oh, yeah.
Now, you know,
Conyers is always on the right track.
And Hanson Clark is terrific. He's taken the place of Carolyn Cheeks Kilpatrick.
Oh, that's right. Good.
He handily defeated her in the primary in 2010.
I think people are a little sick of the name Kilpatrick.
So among liberal Democrats, Sandra Levin and Gary Peters both voted.
Went with Obama.
Yeah, went. And I was thinking, and they're going to put their two House districts together.
Together, right.
Yeah, and I'm thinking, these guys are useless anyways. Who cares? You have one.
Let's get someone a little more rad in there and defeat both of them.
You only get one pro-war vote rather than two. So then, on the other hand, there was a measure that would have denied funding for the Libyan adventure. And that failed. I'm sorry. Let me see. How did that go? This is too complicated. But in other words, they refused to cut off funds for the war in Libya.
Yep.
And again,
so it continues.
It was only Conyers and Hanson, those two congressmen, that said that. So, folks, as it was and has been throughout American history, it is up to us, the American people, to begin to enter the stage of history in order to make history. And you can do it in a small way here in Detroit. And in some ways, I got to tell you, I don't even know why I am bringing this up, because I don't think it's going to have much of an effect.
Do you feel like people don't listen?
They're listening.
I mean,
know they agree.
By going.
Yeah. There's thousands and thousands and thousands of you listening. And whenever Jalene and I announce a demonstration, that some of it's right in your backyard, you know, we'll two people will come up and say, hey, you know, and how do you know? You say, well, how do I know that they're not people at a particular demonstration to support workers' rights as there was a couple months ago or something like that? Or this case, tomorrow morning, well, make that tomorrow afternoon, Monday, June 27th, 4:45 to 5:45, to protest the president's non-withdrawal plan from Afghanistan. This week, he said he's going to take a few troops out. Well, all the waste of money, the slaughter, the injuries, the death, the destruction of Afghan society is going to continue. And how
so
do
this
I?
This is at 9 Mile in Woodward.
9 Mile in Woodward in fashionable Ferndale. And so how do I know, though, that actually everybody there is not from the Night Call show? Well, it is the one thing. We know a lot of the people
There's a community.
There's a community, a peace and social justice community. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it swells. And it swelled, I don't know, a couple hundred people when there was this protest for workers' rights a couple of months ago. I mean, it should have been 2,000. It should have been 20,000.
Yep.
Because when you say workers' rights, that means almost all of us. Anybody that works for a living is having their money wasted, their money stolen, their services and their what we've struggled so hard for eroded. And everyone has a vested interest in that. Everyone has a vested interest in stopping this war. So why in the world you don't come out for it? I don't know. Somebody said, why is it 4:45? You know, I don't get off work till 5:30. Well, you know, okay, that's a problem. Some of you, I don't know why. And I'm sorry, I never do this, which essentially is grab people by their
collars?
Their collars and say, come on, man, you know, you got to do this.
Are you shaking them up a bit?
Yeah, but I, you know, in a way I'm doing that now because this stuff, and I almost said the word, this stuff is serious. No. I mean, we are at a cusp in the history of this country and maybe in the history of this world. And I always say this, there's two ways that people are affected by history. One, they are the object of history. That is, they are objects that are moved by other forces. They are not players. They are not the subject of history. I mean, when you talk about the American Revolution or the Civil War or any kind of movement that really altered American history or world history, the entry of masses of people, I mean, it's not always what changes history, but when history has been changed by masses of people, that's when individuals group together and become the subject of history.
And nothing's ever going to happen ever if the collective are apathetic to all of this.
Yeah.
Nothing will change.
Yeah. And what's happening, a friend of mine who's a lawyer who is pretty active in politics, and I sent him this piece about Obama and violating the War Powers Act, and he wrote back, I am done voting forever. I am so tired of Bush Obama. Wish you well and hope all is going well. Richard. And and then this morning at breakfast, we went to breakfast with some friends. And this other guy, who is really a astute observer of politics, said, same thing. I'm just tired of these guys. They're all the same. They're not.
Well, but it makes me sad because, you know, I know it pains one, it pains me to vote for the lesser of the two evils, but...
Which is better?
The Republicans or the lesser of two evils.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm going to go with that.
And the deal is that the mistake that people make, and I had no illusions about Barack Obama. I knew he was center right in his politics. He said the U.S. was fighting the wrong war and he was going to finish the job, if you will, in Afghanistan and on and on. And he's a great compromiser, a temporizer, actually, and is always granting too much ground to the Republicans, who are in the minority. I mean, the Democrats control the presidency, the Democrats control the Senate, and Barack Obama and a lot of the Democrats act like they were, you know, just sort of an afterthought of it all. So the point being is that I can easily, with all of the, what can I say, all the criticisms I have, and they're great ones, of Barack Obama, I will easily go vote for him again, but not count on him to end any war or defend Social Security or defend Medicare or defend, you know. I mean,
there will be no delusions of grandeur.
Right. So, the
so
good news...
I hope to see you tomorrow, everybody.
Yeah, and we'll announce this a couple times. Hey, you can go to my website, Peter Werbe, WERBE.com. All the information is there as well. Well, New York is now allowing same-sex marriages. The Gay Pride March, can you imagine that? 500,000 people turned out.
It was 44,000 here, so think about 500,000 there. That's I read in the Free Press that it was...
There were 44,000. When was there a Gay Pride March?
They just call it Pride. I mean, the march is part of it.
They had an event at
downtown
Park Plaza.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
So imagine 500,000 people, and they had a lot of reason to celebrate.
Well, how about this? There was 700 in Detroit. What is there? 714,000 people.
Yeah.
And 500,000 people came out for that. in New York City today.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah. And I sure would have gone.
Yeah, I have friends who were there, and
they're
probably going to get married now.
Did you see any of the films of that? The videos. Oh, sorry, wrong century. Film at 11.
No, I have not seen anything. No.
I mean, the joyous, celebratory mood of it all was just astounding. I mean, I have never, or so rarely have seen so many happy people because, you know, there's a lot of legal and formalistic reasons why, you know, that people would want the right to marry who they love. But ultimately, it was saying, hey, this society recognizes you as a human being.
Yeah, I mean, because guess what? You are a human being.
Yeah.
You really are. And I don't understand the hatred and I understand that it's a lot of fear-based, religion-based, but I'll never get it.
You know, it was amazing, too. Naturally, most of the Republicans in New York State voted against it. But it was 33-29 approved by the Senate. Four members of the Republican majority joined all but one Democrat in the Senate in supporting the measure.
They should be very proud of themselves.
Yeah, they should. With his position still undeclared, this was before the vote, state senator in New York, Mark J. Crisanti, a Republican from Buffalo, he had sought office promising to oppose same-sex marriage. Told his Senate colleagues he had agonized for months before concluding he had been wrong. Mr. Grisanti said, "I apologize for those who feel offended. I cannot deny a person, a human being, a taxpayer, a worker for the people of my district and across the state of New York, and those people who make this the great state that it is, the same rights that I have with my wife."
I applaud him.
Yeah, indeed. And one of the things, and I remember, this is so impossible a task, so maybe we shouldn't even put this out. But, you know, this Archbishop Dolan, he's been awful in the things he said, but he said, "I love the gay community."
And where is he? In New York?
Oh, in New York, yeah, the Archbishop of New York. Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, they've got so many gay people in the church. you should.
Yeah, love your brothers.
You love your brothers, yeah, but not if they're, you know, underage.
And sisters.
Yeah, and... I remember what I was going to say. We asked, what harm could gay marriage, same-sex marriage, marriage equality hurt? How does it hurt? I mean, I've been married to the same woman for a very long time. Hasn't hurt us. In fact, it warms my heart. It warms my heart to see people in love. It warms my heart to people committing to one another for, a lifetime. You know, it doesn't always work for a lifetime.
No.
But I don't care. I don't care whether they're men and women, women and women, men and men, whatever. I mean, if you have religious objection to it, I got a real good answer for that.
What is it?
Don't do it. Yeah. And if you think those people are going to go to hell or something like that, you know.
Well, sir, that's twisted.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's twisted, but some people believe.
It's hateful.
Well, it is. And you can see the difference in the crowds when you have these people, when they finally are given the right to have the same respect for their love and their relationship, the joy bubbling over in their faces. I mean, it almost makes me want to cry.
I know.
To see people that, you're supposed to cry. Well, I guess guys aren't supposed to cry at weddings, are they? but in any event, it's just so much happiness. Then you see...
The hate of these people,
and you know, you could substitute almost, you know, you say, they don't exactly say this, but you know, we hate gays. You could just put blacks, you could put Jews, you could put gypsies.
You're just haters.
Yeah, you could put anybody throughout human history that was not respected oftentimes by the majority.
And there you go.
Yeah. One of the things is, I mean, and excuse me for being presumptuous, but if you have, like, for instance, a religious or cultural or some sort of objection to marriage equality, I think, you know, you can, I mean, I respect gentle persuasion, right?
Okay.
You can say
it depends on the case.
Yeah. I mean, for one thing, there's that old song from the 20s, "Ain't nobody's business if I do."
Right.
So you don't have any real right, as far as I'm concerned, to go up in somebody's face and say, gently, "I think you're going to hell because you're committing a sin."
Yeah, yeah.
Which is a lot better than screaming in their face with your face all twisted and contorted, to be sure.
Right. Absolutely.
But in the main, just, you know, get over it, right?
Yeah, please.
Yeah. Yeah.
Get over it.
But is there anybody? I'm still
get a life.
Hey, you know when what was this? Proposition 7 was challenged in federal court. This was a federal state proposition that would ban gay marriage in California, and they asked the people who promoted with millions and millions of dollars mm-hmm. Proposition 7, how does this harm people? How does this harm either the gay people that would be getting married, or how does this harm
the so-called
traditional marriage or the yeah. churches or whatever? And they said in open court that they couldn't come up with a good reason.
That's so funny.
I mean,
I love it.
Folks, when old white conservatives like Dick Cheney, who has a you know, a gay daughter, and Ted Olson, who mm-hmm. you know, these dyed-in-the-wool conservative Republicans are okay with it. You got to get over it.
Yeah, please.
Yeah.
Work on this. Work it out.
And for you guys, just think about those two women. And don't even think about the guys, okay? Forget about the guys.
Yeah, just don't.
Put your head, I mean, because yeah. you're thinking about it.
Right.
I mean, I used to have people.
Think about that.
I used to have people that they would actually call up and say, when I think about what they, and I'm saying, wait. You're thinking about what they do? Don't think about what they do.
Why are you thinking about
it? Yeah, why are you thinking about it?
Think about you and your lady.
Yeah.
Whatever.
Yeah. Okay. So I don't know. I don't think anybody's jumping to tell us why gay marriage is messed up or anything like that.
Yeah, well, feel free. We have an hour and a half of show
yeah.
left.
Stay on the phones, folks. I just want to bring up one more thing. And I wonder, this is a little about things that alter our body by what we ingest, which I guess is almost anything we ingest, right?
Yeah.
But did you see this? Federal health officials say they have their final selection of 9 graphic warning labels to cover the top half of cigarette packages beginning next year. And, well, gee, how about this? Over the opposition of tobacco manufacturers.
Yeah.
Because they want to keep, you know, they're in trouble because their best customers die at such a fast clip, right? They got to keep replacing them. And they're going to have these warning labels, which has graphic images, including photos of horribly damaged teeth and lungs and a man exhaling smoke through a tracheotomy opening in his neck.
I could hardly look at that.
Yeah, I didn't even look at him.
Oh, I saw that one briefly.
Now, we need some Canadian callers. I think they have it on Canadian cigarettes.
Yeah, I've heard that they do.
Yeah. The government won a case about this last year in federal court on its overall ability to require larger warning labels with images. And the Kentucky case is before the United States Court of Appeals for the Sixth Circuit. The new labels were required under landmark anti-smoking legislation, giving the Food and Drug Administration power to regulate but not ban tobacco products. Now, I don't know. I wonder, you smokers, is this going to be a deterrent? I doubt it. I mean, they have jiggered the contents of tobacco so much that there's, you know, heavy addiction. And when we've talked about smoking before, remember, I don't have these figures off the top of my head, for every person that does, well, say like heroin, 18% are addicted. Maybe it's higher. I don't know. But it's not even 50%.
But Ciggies,
100%.
Yeah.
There's nobody that's had a couple cigarettes. You know, there's probably one or two. But, you know.
They didn't like it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, the first time I smoked cigarettes, I mean, I caught, you know, these kids. I was about, I think I was 12.
Oh, nice.
And these kids said, you got to light it up, and you got to suck in as deep as you can.
Oh, no.
Well, naturally, I coughed so uncontrollably. And, you always see people doing that with, with reefer.
Other things, yeah.
Yeah. But this was tobacco. And they laughed and laughed and laughed.
They got you.
Oh, yeah, they did it to me. And then, but I kept doing it. And then you get buzzed. I mean, I didn't know
there's
that.
There's a certain buzz.
I got dizzy, you know. And so I smoked for 8 years.
Wow, Peter.
Until I was 20.
8 years.
And my girlfriend, now my wife,
yeah.
refused to kiss me.
Oh, yes. I know this story. Yeah.
Yeah. So that might work. Gals, if you want to, you know. I mean, she would. Oh. beautiful, still is. Where are we on the air? Yeah, we are. And, you know, she would come at me the way only a beautiful 20-year-old woman would with her lips apart. We'd almost be ready to kiss, and she'd go, "Oh, you smell terrible."
I can see her doing that.
Yeah.
Because I do know her.
So, I don't know if you have any opinion on it. Is that going to work? So, we know how dangerous. I mean, this is a dumb A argument, you know, to compare the death and destruction that of, you know, families that occurs because of smoking compared to marijuana, where there's never a single death from.
Yep, that's right.
But a couple of things have happened. The former Seattle U.S. attorney is now pushing for pot legalization, as is the former police chief of Seattle, Norm Stampler, who I've interviewed before. And U.S. lawmakers on Thursday introduced a bill that would legalize marijuana nationwide, but allow each state to regulate, tax, and control the drug. And Congressman Barney Frank, a Democrat of Massachusetts, introduced the bill. And it doesn't say here, but I think Ron Paul did as well. And I could imagine, being a libertarian, he wouldn't want laws against that. They admit that it has virtually no chance of becoming law. And why? I mean, talk about money ill spent. 850,000 Americans were arrested in 2009 for marijuana-related offenses, 90% of them for possession.
Now they could make the money. The states could make the money through the sale of it if they legalize it. And, you know, I think a lot of people would be okay with that.
Yeah.
Because they wouldn't risk, you know, getting in trouble for it, for something that just...
And it
makes them feel better.
And it really ruins people's lives. I mean, people lose jobs. They have it on their record. They can't get jobs in a tight market. And, oh, by the way, just one thing back to gay marriage and New York.
Mm-hmm.
The state estimates, because of the passage of this marriage equality law, they think they will have an uptick in the economy of $200 million.
Wow.
Which was, I'm sure, not...
it was taken into consideration.
Not unconsiderable.
Right,
you
know it.
Because people are going to be flocking there. I mean, absolutely flocking there. In fact, I know that, you know, that woman who I deal with is a publicist.
Yeah.
Yeah. They go to every I don't know how you can do this. They go to every state where she and her companion go to every state.
What
is there, six of them now?
Where you can get married.
Where you can get married and get married.
Do they really? They're having a good time.
Yeah. They always, and they put
That's
in,
a hoot.
I wonder if they, what do they do that, you know, when you get married, you put a list of your gifts you want in it. What do they call that?
Oh, the registry?
Yeah. I wonder if they keep doing that.
I doubt it.
Right. Hey, folks, you're on the line. Stephen and Susie and Corey and John and Richard and Scott. You hang on and we'll get your calls when we come back.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Julene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Let your opinion be heard. Call us at 313-298-WRIF.
Whatever's going on, it seems to be far from over.
Peter and Julene will be taking more of your calls right after this.
Is it time for a new roof? Call Sears Roofing. You can save $500 if you call right now. Just call 1-877-938-1414. Hurry, offer ends soon. Not available in all states. Installation provided by Sears Authorized Licensed Contractors. License information available upon request. Get your roofing job done right. Call Sears Roofing now. You can save $500. Call now. 1-877-938-1414. Sears.
How do you get the most satisfaction? For some career-minded people, it's when they work toward a goal and reach it. The same may apply to you when preparing for your career. In fields like electronics technology, information technology, and drafting and design, you need knowledge and skills to get started. That's why you should call ITT Technical Institute. At ITT Tech, you can develop knowledge and skills to pursue opportunities in a variety of career fields. Call 800-741-5123. ITT Tech's programs are designed to help you develop skills and knowledge to pursue your career interest. Classes and day or evening courses meet just a few days a week, and financial aid is available for those who qualify. So pick up the phone right now and call ITT Tech for more information. Call 800-741-5123. 800-741-5123. That's ITT Tech. 800-741-5123.
Do you have a disability that prevents you from working? Then you may be entitled to collect thousands of dollars of Social Security benefits. If you've been medically disabled for at least 12 months and previously worked 5 of the last 10 years, you may qualify to receive thousands of dollars paid directly to you every month. Just call Disability Benefits Alliance at 1-877-941-8822. Disability Benefits Alliance can cut through government red tape and help you receive Social Security disability.
These days, people of all ages, including adults, can have a perfect smile. Thanks to today's technology, people with crooked teeth may no longer need to wear metal braces. One option many adults prefer is invisible braces. Instead of the typical metal bands or brackets that are cemented to teeth, these braces are clear plastic trays. Some advantages of invisible braces are they can be removed for eating and for brushing and flossing. They are practically invisible to see, and they are less irritating to gums than traditional braces. Keep in mind that invisible braces are only available for people who need minor corrective work. If you are considering braces and would like to learn more about invisible braces, speak with your dentist. You're never too old for a beautiful smile. For the ADA Dental Minute, I'm Dr. Maria Lopez-Howell. For more information, visit our website at ada.org.
This is your Travel Minute. If you're planning a flight for business or pleasure anytime soon, here's the 3-1-1 rule for carry-on luggage to ease your way through airport security lines. Rule 1. Only 3-ounce or smaller containers of liquid or gel are permitted in carry-on luggage. However, larger containers are permitted in your check-in baggage. 2. Place your 3-ounce or smaller containers into one 1-quart size clear plastic zip-top bag. Only one bag per traveler is allowed. 3. Place the bag into the security bin with your shoes and other items as required for scanning. The rules for other personal items vary, so it's a good idea to check with your airline or travel agent before you pack for your trip.
Your Travel Minute is a public service by this station and ASTA, the American Society of Travel Agents.
Is your air conditioning working? Do your carpets need cleaning? Or maybe you're ready to have your house painted. Big or small, whatever your home improvement need. Now it's easy to find the right home pro for your project. Log on to fixitfast.servicemagic.com. Service Magic is a free online resource with instant access to pre-screened remodelers, roofers, maids, and many other home contractors. Just go to fixitfast.servicemagic.com. Service Magic has a network of licensed and insured contractors in hundreds of home improvement categories. If you need an electrician, plumber, architect, or any other home service, visit fixitfast.servicemagic.com. It's easy and it's free, and it's the source to find neighbor-recommended contractors in your area. Now you can hire a pre-screened home pro with confidence. Go to fixitfast.servicemagic.com. It's quick, it's free, and there's no obligation. Go to fixitfast.servicemagic.com. That's fixitfast.servicemagic.com.
What do you see yourself doing a few years from now? Thinking about a career is one thing, but preparing for a career is what really counts. If an education in information technology, electronics technology, or drafting and design could help you prepare, then check out the technology-focused programs offered at ITT Technical Institute. Call ITT Tech at 800-741-5123. At ITT Tech, you can develop knowledge and skills to pursue opportunities in a variety of career fields. Classes in day or evening courses meet just a few days a week, and financial aid is available for those who qualify. So if you want to prepare for a career involving technology, look to a leader in technology education. Get started by calling ITT Tech. For more information, call 800-741-5123. 800-741-5123. That's ITT Tech. 800-741-5123.
We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF. Voice your opinion at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Here are Peter and Julie.
All right, thank you very much, and welcome back. A lot of hot subjects on under discussion. Gay marriage, okay, in New York. In fact, they don't even call it gay marriage. They call it marriage equality. That's a nice word for a democratic society where people, in fact, all are guaranteed that.
Well, and they really are equal.
You know, I don't understand why this has never been brought to court under the Equal Protection Clause of the Constitution. That everyone has to get equal protection under the law. I don't
right.
get it.
Yeah, yeah, good point.
All right, we've got a full boat of callers. I just wanted to bring this up. And earlier, Jolene and I were saying how we used to have all these people disagreeing with us. And the other thing about nuclear energy, too, yeah. right? And now with what happened at Fukuyama, and we begin to learn increasingly what's happening to these nuclear power plants here in our area.
United States, yeah.
Yeah, the research of the group Beyond Nuclear, who I've interviewed representatives before, found that leaking U.S. reactors are now ubiquitous, means everywhere, and that at least 102 reactor units are now documented to have recurring radioactive leaks into groundwater from 1960 through February 2009. The Associated Press investigation entitled Radioactive Tritium Leaks found at 48 U.S. nuke sites. And they concluded radioactive tritium has leaked from 3/4 of U.S. commercial nuclear power sites, often into groundwater from corroded buried piping. Leaks from at least 37 of these facilities contained concentrations exceeding the federal drinking water standard, sometimes at hundreds of times the limit.
They're poisoning us.
Yeah, so no nukes. People agree with that. So what? We marriage equality, no nukes, end the war. What else? Legalize it, Mon.
Legalize it, Mon. Eat the rich.
Yeah, eat the rich, too. We'll do that later.
Take away all the power from the corporations. Yeah. Well, most of it, anyway.
Yep. All right, one of the things we mentioned, too, is that they're going to put these new labels on ciggies. Cigarettes,
yeah.
And they're going to just, you know, people's rotted lungs and all that.
Let's
hear Susie. Susie's calling from Dearborn Heights. Hi, Susie. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
I just wanted to let you know that you really can't hear you when you're on the phone. You can't hear the recording. But anyways.
Wait a minute. When you're on hold waiting to get on the show.
You have a hard time hearing?
Well, I heard it when you guys started talking again, but when the commercials were on, it completely goes away almost.
Supposed to.
So maybe people will hang up thinking that they're disconnected or something.
Oh, that's weird. Okay, well, just know that it's silent. I mean, it's a legal thing.
But let me tell you this, Susie. You're a smoker, right?
No, I am a former smoker.
I know. I could tell by your voice, I hate to say.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, no, I quit smoking 20 years ago. Anyway,
she just has nice pipes.
You do have a good voice. You have a nice voice. I didn't mean it wasn't nice. Go ahead.
Well, what I wanted to say was that I don't think it'll do any good because... You know, people who are smokers, they're not even going to look after the first couple times. But I do think that it might have an effect on the little kids that see the empty packs or the packs on their mom's table.
Oh, yeah.
Or on the ground and see those pictures that maybe they'll never start. You know?
Yeah, I could see that.
Some kids do say to their parents, stop smoking.
A lot of kids.
My daughter did that.
Yeah.
She told me that for years. And then when I finally quit, she was smoking.
Oh no.
And she's still smoking years later.
Well, I mean, if we had our choice between cigarettes being illegal or marijuana being illegal.
Oh, cigarettes.
Yeah, but you know what? Then probably the same sort of, well, you know, actually you can grow marijuana in your backyard. Tobacco, the whole process. It's a little tougher. All right, Susie, thank you so much.
Thanks for calling
313-298-9743. Here is Corey in Roseville. Hi, Corey. You're on the air.
Hey, how you guys doing?
We're great.
Hey, hi, Corey.
Good. I just wanted to get you guys' opinion, since we're talking about gay marriage, about same-sex marriage adoption.
Well, right now, any number of states, gay people can adopt children, and that's happened. Yeah. I mean, usually people don't have any problem with two women. Because that's like double the maternal nurturing. Usually when they have trouble, if they have trouble with it at all, they're thinking about two guys. And a lot of
I say go for it. I think it's great. I know a lot of gay couples who have adopted and have wonderful children. They all have wonderful lives and children who have grown up to be wonderful adults as well. And, come on. It's really becoming pretty mainstream. You look at Neil Patrick Harris, Elton John, all of these gay men in the celebrity types.
Yeah.
It's really just.
And you know, there's actually studies of which I'm not can't roll them off the top of my head about do that, you know, what's then the sexual sexuality of the kids?
Oh, who have gay parents. Yeah. And I think they're more straight than not. Okay. It doesn't determine it. And, you know, then you think about the adoption. It really is a genetic thing, so.
Sure. It's not a choice. Yeah, all right. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Peter.
Thank you for bringing that up, Corey. Appreciate that. Here is John. John is in Sterling Heights. Hi, John. You're on the air.
How you doing, Peter?
Hey.
Julian Jordan.
Yes. Hi. John.
What's 500,000? No, 50 million. 50 million Republicans laying on the bottom of the ocean calls.
Oh, no. No,
don't tell me a good start.
A darn good start.
Oh, yeah. My gosh.
It used to be lawyers. I changed it to Republicans.
It is. No, they used to say, what's 10 lawyers on the bottom of the Detroit River?
Oh, boy. Yeah.
We don't want any harm to come to our Republican
leaders. Well, I don't know. I think, you know, if you look at all the laws that have been abolished by the Republican Party over the years, those laws were made by men over, say, from 1900 till now, because corporations were ripping off the American people.
Right.
The Democrats just didn't come in and say, we're taking over, we want to expand the government, we want to control everything. Good men, for many years, started unions, and they started these laws. They enacted laws like the Truth in Lending Law, which Bush abolished. Reagan abolished the Communications Act or whatever it was, and now you've got five committees.
I think that was Clinton.
That was Clinton.
Also, John, Republicans were, you know.
But Reagan did a lot of really bad things. Worst president ever. So
worst president
we'll give
ever,
you that.
Indeed. But in 100 years ago, when there was this whole string of Republican presidents other than Woodrow Wilson, they passed all sorts of progressive legislation and were forward-thinking in terms of regulating business and the monetary supply and all of that. And remember that old Nixon signed the Environmental Protection Act and the Clean Water Act, and I always forget any number of other things as well. But the Republicans today are another breed. They want to end, I was with some friends, these guys, man, I was the only person in, oh no, and my wife, the two of us were the only people in the room without a college education. And if we would have had a bachelor's degree, we would have been the only people in the room with only a bachelor's degree.
Right.
And if we would have had master's degrees.
That would be it?
Well, there were people with master's, but a lot of them were college profs and all that. Really, really good people, really bright. And one of them was saying, John, that what the Republicans are doing is attempting to upend this settlement. I kept that word. I talked to the guy later. This settlement that was put in place essentially by the New Deal, by Roosevelt, to say, look, we can't continue this situation where we solely have this ultra-rich ruling upper class that makes all the decisions, and then everybody below it are just sort of peons and peasants and lowly workers. So the unions then went into operation, and between the agreement of the forward seeing section of the ruling class and the ability of the unions to organize and demand from the corporations that didn't go for the program, like Ford Motor and what have you, they actually created a large middle class. The Republicans today are like from the 19th century, and they want to undo this settlement. Partly, I don't even know what their motivation, I was going to try to guess at their motivation. There is so much wealth in this country and in this world that could satisfy the needs of everyone, so we wouldn't be scrambling around at the margins about taking 10% from these workers, or saying, you know, you can't have a raise, or you got to pay more for this, or, you know, we got to fire teachers. There's enough money in this country, in this world, mm-hmm. for everyone to live decently, and still to have these rich SOBs live like the rich SOBs that they are.
They'll be fine.
They could still have all their riches and
their yachts and their travel.
Yeah. So it's mostly impacted wealth that's just sitting there doing nothing. All right. Thank you very much, John. I appreciate that. Actually, we here. This was in, you know, the Guardian newspaper and a lot of papers in the UK and England. They're better observers of this country than any paper here.
They really are.
Yeah. This is world's wealthiest people now richer than before the credit crunch. We are not all in this together, says Jill Traynor, a writer for The Guardian newspaper. The UK economy is flat, the US is weak, and the Greek debt crisis is threatening another meltdown. But a news report shows the world's wealthiest people are, guess what? Are getting richer!
Yeah, well, we've been saying that all along. Yeah. This just confirms everything that we've said here.
And also, there's more of them. There's more of them. The globe's riches have now recouped the losses they suffered from 2008 when the banking crisis occurred. They are richer than ever, and there are more of them, nearly 11 million than before the recession struck.
So everyone else is poorer than ever. They're wealthier than ever.
Well, yeah. I mean, wealth, it can be created, but even if it is created, you know, the whole social and economic and political question is, how is it distributed? Well, it's all being distributed upwards. None of it, you know, there's no trickle-down economics. It's all going up. In the world of the well-heeled, the rich are referred to as, you ready for this, folks? High net worth individuals, or HNWIs, and defined as people have more than $1 million of free cash. And we're talking now, I don't even know if this is 5% of the population. According to the annual World Wealth Report by Merrill Lynch, the wealth of HNWIs around the world reached $42.7 trillion. $42.7 trillion. Do you realize with that kind of money equitably spread? I mean, and I'm not talking about everybody getting the same amount, but just in a decent way. Bush could have even fought his two wars and, you know, whatever the phony reasons for him were. And the $2 million would have been, or $2 trillion that it's cost us would have been nothing.
In 1 year, it went up 10%.
The wealth of them. The report also measured a category of ultra high net worth individuals, those with at least $30 million rattling around looking for a home. The number of individuals in the super rich bracket climbed 10% to a total of 103,000. In other words, there's 6 billion of us. 103,000 people each have $30 million or more. And if there's anyone out there saying, and they earned it, I don't even get that. How the hell did they earn it? It's this system that allows this wealth to accrue in that manner. And what would make sense, given that the fact that that people are fighting over resources, that people are, there's still tens of millions of people that starve to death every year, that there's hundreds and hundreds of millions of people that are at risk from starvation. There's disease still rampant around it, you know, and do we begin to talk about our country? That if these people were taxed at the top marginal rate of 90% once they got over, say, 5 million, that the problems would all be solved, at least in terms of money.
Yeah, the whole health care situation would be a lot better.
How dare you want to take their money? And they're left with $5 million a year.
That's a lot of money.
Yeah, you got to be crazy if you would rather have the travail that exists in this world, in this country,
right,
and in this city, rather than forcing some poor guy to only exist on $5 million a year. You won't make $5 million in your lifetime.
Yeah, Peter, these cats don't care. It's not even a blip on their radar.
Yeah, yeah.
I believe that.
Let's see. Most of the wealth is concentrated in the U.S., Japan, and Germany. Huh, I would have thought England, too. 53% of the world's most wealthy live in one of those three countries. All right, let's go back to our phones. Here is Richard in Detroit. Hi, Richard. You're on the air.
Crickets.
Crickets,
hey,
yeah.
Hey, we cut off...
Richard, we did it to you.
It was our old buddy. Hey, man.
It wasn't.
Yeah.
Okay.
I heard him start.
Okay. All right. Here is Stephen in Pontiac. Hey, Stephen, you're on the air. Hi.
Hey, what's up?
How you doing? We're good.
Great, hi.
What's up?
Well, quick thing about the cigarettes. After you guys mentioned that, I went to the store and bought a pack because I forgot that I needed some cigarettes.
We're glad we could enable you.
Let me just tell you real quickly, Steve.
In a twisted way, dude.
I've had people that were recovering addicts say that the advertising that was done by this, I can't remember the name of it, the anti...
Drug-free partnership.
Yeah, for America.
Yeah.
They spend millions and millions of our tax dollars on that stuff. And this guy called in one time and he told me, every time I see one of those fried egg things, and saying, this is your brain on drugs, he would want to go score.
Yeah.
Well, when I was Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, it made me want to drink. Is that the one where he drinks himself to death, Nick Cage?
Go ahead, though.
That was just a quick blurb. I wanted to talk about really the economy and how it's supposed to be doing or whatever. You know, John was saying all this stuff about how, and you guys were saying how the modern Republicans are trying to upend the settlement. And really, you know, I have this quote etched into my memory from Thomas Jefferson, I think it was. And he said, "We men fought with hard knocks for freedom. Our children brought up easy, let it slip away, and our grandchildren once more are slaves." Huh. And that's really true. Like, the unions back in the 40s and 50s were fighting tooth and nail to get jobs and make it work. And now there's just so much complacency.
Well, it's what's that old phrase? I mean, the unions are always outnumbered, always outgunned. And, mm-hmm. I think all of my union friends that are listening, I hope they're not offended, but they frequently aren't taking advantage of the resources that they have. Because, I mean, the unions still are these huge institutions.
But there aren't enough people. Like, there's not, like you guys said earlier on the show, like, when the public is really just so passe about all these issues that are going on, it doesn't create a really good atmosphere socially, economically, for our politicians to really feel the need. Like, we have to do something. The people are up in arms, but
yeah,
no,
you're
one
absolutely
is up in
arms. Yeah, you are 100%
those
right.
Those pesky little protests, if they even know.
Yeah. I mean, if there's 200 of us show up, like there might be tomorrow. Are we still in Sunday?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Tomorrow on the corner of 9 Mile and Woodward, that is going to be at 4:45 p.m. to protest Barack Obama's continuing war in Afghanistan. If 200 of us show up, you know, no one's going to say anything. If 20,000 people showed up, as well they should, because this affects all of us, think of the cutbacks just in those cities around there, Ferndale and Pleasant Ridge and Hazel Park and Oak Park and Southfield, Madison Heights, yeah. That if there was 20,000 people out there, suddenly these guys that vote pro-war, like Sander Levin, Democrats, and Gary Peters, they would be over there saying, yeah, let's end the war. So, Stephen, you're absolutely right. We have got, you know what, remember there's one of my favorite bumper stickers is too long and I'd never put it in my car anyway. But it said, if the people lead, the leaders will follow.
Yeah.
That's essentially what you're saying.
Yeah.
All right, we got to take a break. Stephen, thank you very much. Stay with us. If you're on hold, we'll be right back. And I want to tell you about a guy that robbed a bank to get medical care.
He did.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Julene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Peter and Julene are taking your calls at 313-298-WRIF.
That's what we do.
We'll be taking more of your calls right after this.
Rates, policy forms, and availability vary by state. Did you know that life insurance rates are near record lows? If you own life insurance or are thinking of buying any, why spend more than you have to? I'm Byron Udell, founder of AccuQuote. Since 1986, we've helped hundreds of thousands of people just like you save a fortune on their life insurance. Here's how we do it. We monitor the products offered by dozens of the most well-respected brand-name life insurance companies you trust so that you get the lowest rates. For example, a healthy 40-year-old can buy $500,000 of 10-year level term for less than $21 a month. 20 and 30-year rates are also available. And don't forget to ask us about the new term life plans that guarantee your money back even if you don't die. Take 5 minutes and call AccuQuote for your free quote at 800-654-2075. Find out how much you can save on your life insurance. Call AccuQuote today at 800-654-2075. That's 800-654-2075.
When it's raining hard outside, can your roof still keep out the leaks inside? If it's time for a new roof, get your roofing installed the right way with Sears. Call Sears for a free in-home consultation at 1-877-938-1414. You can save $500 if you call right now. Sears licensed, fully insured contractors can get your roofing job done right. Sears has a variety of shingles and styles that are built for long-lasting performance, and you'll save $500 if you call now. So, for roofing done right, call Sears for a free in-home consultation at 1-877-938-1414. Hurry, offer ends soon. Not available in all states. Installation provided by Sears Authorized Licensed Contractors. License information available upon request. That's Sears Roofing. Call right now and save $500. Call 1-877-938-1414. That's 1-877-938-1414. Sears.
This is Dan Tullis, and I just called
Joel Clark,
one of Select Quote Insurance Services' term life agents.
Hi, Mr. Tullis.
Joel, how does Select Quote save you money on term life insurance?
Well, buying term life insurance is all about choosing the right company. Let's say you take antidepressants or you smoke. All insurance companies are going to price that differently. We'll impartially shop all the companies we represent to find you the best price.
Can you give me an example?
Sure. I just got a man, 40 years old, who takes blood pressure medication. A $500,000 policy with a highly rated insurance company is priced $21 a month.
Call 1-800-928-6929 and see how affordable term life insurance can be. That's 1-800-928-6929. 1-800-928-6929. Or go to selectquote.com. We shop, you save. Get full details on the example policy at selectquote.com/commercials. Your price could vary depending on your health, issuing company, and other factors. Not available in all states.
Our son would go from, "Good morning, Mom," to words you'd never expect to come out of your child's mouth. Our pain came from not knowing what to do. He was diagnosed with paranoid schizophrenia. 5 or 6 years later, he was diagnosed with obsessive compulsive disorder. I think the hardest part of living with someone who has a mental illness is thinking that you're alone, that no one else could understand. NAMI, the National Alliance on Mental Illness, is made up of people who live it every day. We lean on each other and we learn from each other. NAMI doesn't let anyone give up hope. My name is Mary Tadikin, and I can tell you what NAMI has meant for my family. It has meant that we are a family.
One in five adults lives with depression, schizophrenia, anxiety, or other mental illnesses. NAMI provides education and support to these families and individuals. To find a local chapter, go to NAMI.org or call 800-950-NAMI.
Is it time to replace your home's carpet or flooring? Call Sears Flooring to get shop-at-home convenience you can trust. Sears Flooring brings the showroom to you with a wide range of carpet, tile, hardwood, and laminate. And if you call right now, you'll save 20%. Call for a free in-home consultation at 1-888-491-3939. Sears Flooring has many styles to match your home and your budget. Your new flooring will be precisely installed, and your satisfaction is guaranteed. So call Sears Flooring right now and save 20%. Call 1-888-491-3939. Offer ends soon. Not available in all areas. Installation provided by Sears Authorized Licensed Contractors. License information available upon request. Call Sears Flooring. You'll save 20% if you call now. Call 1-888-491-3939. That's 1-888-491-3939. Sears.
101 WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit. This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Voice your opinion at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Now, here are Peter Werby and Jolene Jordan.
Thank you very much, Ann. Welcome back to our second hour. Hi, Jolene.
Hello.
And we didn't even say, or did we? Oh, we did. I think I did remember saying the names. When you call 313-298-9743, you will reach Athena and Sarah. One or the other, actually.
Uh-huh, yeah.
And they will put our podcast together. It'll be ready in 12 hours.
Yes.
Right, Athena? Right,
yes.
Sarah? I can see their heads.
Right, everybody.
Nodding. Right, everybody. Right, Jade? Right, Jeremy? Okay.
They make it happen.
Man robs bank to get medical care in jail. We're talking now richest country in the world, right? Some people who need medical care but can't afford it go to the emergency room. Others just hope they'll get better. James Verone robbed a bank. That's right. Earlier this month, Verone, 59 years old, he's a convenience store clerk, walked into a Gastonia, North Carolina bank and handed the cashier a note demanding
$1.
Yeah. And medical attention. Then he calmly waited for police to show up. He's now in jail and has an appointment with a doctor this week. He lost his job he'd held for 17 years as a Coca-Cola delivery man in the economic downturn, amid the economic downturn. He found no new work driving a truck. It didn't last. Finally, he had a part-time position only at a convenience store, but he had all sorts of physical problems. The bending and lifting made his back ache. He had problems with his left foot, making him limp, and on and on and on. Then he noticed a protrusion in his chest. He said, "I kind of hit a brick wall with everything." He knew he needed help, but he didn't want to be a burden on his sisters and brothers. He applied for food stamps, but they weren't enough. So he hatched this plan, and he mailed a letter to the Gazette, the newspaper there, listing the return address to the Gaston County Jail. Said, "When you receive this, a bank robbery will be committed by me. The robbery is being committed by me for $1. I am of sound mind, but not so much sound body."
Isn't that something?
Yeah. He said, "I didn't have any fears. I told the teller I would sit over here and wait for the police." The teller was so frightened, she had to be taken to the hospital to be checked out. Verone was taken to jail. Because he'd only asked for $1, he was charged with larceny and not bank robbery. His bail has been reduced to $2,000. He says he doesn't plan to pay it, though. In jail, Verone said he skips dinner to avoid too much contact with other inmates. I don't get that. But he's got all the health care that he needs. He says, "If you don't have your health, you don't have anything." Verone also presented the view that if the United States had a health care system which offered people more government support, he wouldn't have had to make the choice he did. I mean, this is pretty extreme, of course.
Yeah.
Another guy, a homeless man, robbed a Louisiana bank and took a $100 bill, but he felt so remorseful that he surrendered to the police. Roy Brown, 54, robbed the Capital One Bank in Shreveport, Louisiana. And, wow, this is 2007. He had approached the teller with one of his hands under his jacket, and he was handed a stack of bills, but only took a single $100 bill and returned the remaining money to the teller. This is amazing. He said he was homeless and hungry and left the bank. The next day, he surrendered to police, saying that his mother hadn't raised him to be that way. He said he had needed the money to stay at a detox center and had no other place to stay and was hungry. In taking this all into account, in Caddo District Court, he pled guilty. The judge sentenced him to 15 years in prison.
15 years.
15 years in prison.
That Unreal.
Contrasted Unreal. To a recent sentencing of a bankster. The people that have created the mess that we're in, who milked the system, built the system, who are responsible ultimately along with the Republicans and George Bush for the mess that we're in. And one of these guys, Paul R. Allen, nothing to do with the Microsoft guy, but he was a former CEO in Ocala, Florida, in this company called Taylor, Bean & Whitaker. And had been one of the nation's largest privately held mortgage lenders until it collapsed in 2009. And they finally figured out that he had scammed it to the tune of almost $3 billion. So here is, what's this man's name? Roy Brown, who took a $100 bill and he got 15 years. Paul Allen, he got 40 months, 3 years, 4 months.
Yeah, that shows you exactly the state of our system out there.
Yeah, yeah. There's an old song by Woody Guthrie, Arlo Guthrie's father, a great folk singer, great American folk singer that influenced people like Bob Dylan so much. And there's one of my favorite songs, Pretty Boy Floyd.
Mm-hmm.
And you know the line in there? He said, "Some men will rob you with a six gun, other with a fountain pen."
Right, and that is for damn sure.
And we know which one gets punished the most.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Whoa.
Let's take your calls.
Yeah, it scared me. Everything popped off the screen here. But it's back. Let's see. Here's Maurice. Maurice is in Detroit. Go ahead, Maurice. You're at ground zero. Wait a minute. Wait a minute.
No, do that little...
Didn't work here.
Yeah, hold on. Stand by, Maurice. We're coming to you.
Huh. I am... Ooh, this is bad. I am hitting it, and nothing is happening. It ain't my fault. All right.
Okay.
Here, we'll do it.
Wow, weird. We have gremlins.
Yeah.
Everything's been so smooth.
Let me see. 1, 2, 3, 4. It's line 4.
Oh, good luck.
Hey, Maurice, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Pot it up.
Pot it up.
Hello?
What's up?
There we are.
How y'all doing?
We're good. Maurice, we can
hardly
hear you.
Maurice!
Can you hear me now?
Yeah,
there
we can hear you.
You know, I worked for this cab company for almost 4 years, and about 3 weeks ago, Tuesday, the 7th of this month, I get a call around 5 o'clock telling me that the cab company went out of business.
Whoa!
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, no.
The name of the company was called Direct Contact. It was located at 6771 West Vern. The parent company is Trinity Cars. They downriver.
Uh-huh.
Okay, they just shut us down. But I hear he had enough money to buy two Toyota Priuses. But, Kev, they go about $40,000 each, don't they?
They do. They do, yeah.
But you know what?
That's
okay. You know, you work for, you know, not only that, I'm not talking about the employee. I'm talking about the customers in the area, depending on them to get around. Like, screw them, screw everybody. The name of the owner's name is Jerry.
Okay, we don't want to say that. Hey, Maurice, so you...
Maurice, but I...
So you don't have a job? You don't have a job now?
I saved my money.
Yeah, that's good.
You know, I got a few things in the fire that, this week, I should be doing something.
Well, that's good.
We believe in you, Maurice.
Yeah, yeah.
You
know what? What?
I can't say the owner's name of the company.
No, you already did.
No.
But I can't really say it on the radio, can I? No.
You already said the company. That's good enough.
Yeah, that's bad enough.
I got one more last thing to say. He's one greedy bastard.
Oh, okay. Good. Ooh, you scared me there for a minute.
Peter almost jumped over to that dumb button.
Yeah. All right, Maurice, thank you.
Maurice, we're sorry you lost your job. And we wish you drag.
And we wish you the best of luck.
Yeah, we do. There's nothing worse than...
Yeah. And
getting canned.
It sounded like you said the dumb button, but that's about the same. It's called the dump.
Dump.
It says dump on
D-U-M-P.
It because we're on this long. We used to be on a 7-second
delay. Some people are very naughty.
Now we're on a 30-second
delay.
And we
have to cut
them off. Yeah, yeah. You know, one thing I forgot to tell people, that a couple of guests, real interesting, this week at the top of the hour. Let me see. Who are we going to do here? Oh, yeah. A guy named Chris Carlson. He wrote this book called 10 Years That Shook the City, San Francisco, 1968 to 1978.
Ooh.
And it's a real exciting history of that era. And I know some people say, oh, man, they're talking about the 60s again. But I wouldn't do this.
Hey, the 60s were cool.
Yeah, and this has got some great stories, too. And then at 1:30, Jay Rosenstein, pardon me, who's got a PBS documentary called The Lord Is Not on Trial Here Today, and he discusses the importance of this 1945 Supreme Court decision that set the standard for the separation of church and state in schools.
Oh, right on.
Yeah, and let me see, this woman, Vashti McCollum was her name, and they started giving religious education in the public schools way back like in the mid-40s, and Mom, Vashti, said no.
And, Don't do it. I don't want my kids.
And wound up victorious. That. Yeah.
Oh.
Okay. Let's see.
It's hard to believe something like that could have even happened back then, that she was successful.
Yeah, I was. I'm wondering why this is not happening for me. Whoa, I can't even get my screen up here, Jolene.
Peter. Right,
here it comes. Here it comes.
We may have to restart during the next break.
Yeah. Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Okay. Let's continue onward. Here's Dave. Dave's in.
You're gonna have to
isn't
go.
Working.
Yeah.
Okay. You're wondering what I can't do it with the mouse. I have to lean across our control board here. Here is Dave in Livonia. Hi, Dave. You're on the air. Oh, wait a minute, Dave. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah. Dave, hi.
Hi, Dave.
I enjoy your show.
Thank you
very much for taking my call.
Sure.
I was wondering if I could make two points, and one point I wanted to make was about marijuana.
Sure.
And I'm going to kind of preface that by saying we're talking about, air conditioning in the Middle East and Afghanistan and all that stuff. And
which costs the taxpayers $20 billion a year, for
exactly.
Our soldiers, right.
Exactly. But in terms of marijuana... I think marijuana should be legalized. I think that it's a huge drain on the American economy. When you look at the fact that hard liquor, and I'm not going to name any brands or anything like that, has destroyed more lives.
Oh, absolutely.
Than I would say marijuana has. I think that if there was some sort of reform, legalizing it, that the way that would sort of curb, taxpayer dollars would be huge. That's one point I want to make. The other point.
Well, let me just comment on it. Part of what the laws have turned out to be, pardon me, what the marijuana laws do, along with all the drug laws, is they provide clients for the prison industrial complex. And here is another case, like the military budget, where private wealth, in other words, what you and I create by working, or if we have a small business or something, most of us are workers, and it transfers it to the government, and the government can do any one of a number of things with it. The things we like them to do the most are teachers, fire, police, roads, cultural stuff, parks, stuff like that. However, what they're doing in this case is they're building prisons, which creates construction jobs. They're hiring prison guards. All that has to be supplied. So what it essentially is we're paying. What would you say? It's sort of this sort of Ponzi scheme, where this money that could be used more effectively in other parts of the economy go to support the sector that actually does tremendous harm to people. You got to remember, the marijuana laws, all the laws against drugs are ostensibly put in there to protect us because they don't want us harmed by drugs. So they are going to put us in jail if we possess them, because the government doesn't want us harming ourselves with drugs. If anyone wants to sell it to us, they will also be. In the meantime, though, it's been a tremendous failure. It's created, I can't even remember the figures, like tens of millions of people arrested, corrupted innumerable governments, and guess what? I won't even ask you to guess. It is more readily available, more powerful, and more expensive, creates more profits, and still, on into the big muddy, as the song goes. Okay, go ahead. What's your second point?
My second point, I guess, would be, and I guess this is a state, for the state of Michigan thing, though, talking in terms of draining on the economy is, wasting money on, going after, somebody who's got a dime bag or something like that. One thing that I think would be an incredible boon for the economy in the state of Michigan would be welfare reform. I mean, there are no checks and balances on welfare.
Sure there are.
Yeah.
Well,
I mean, there's tons of it. I mean, they do these studies. I mean, there's very little fraud that goes on, and there's no more of this able-bodied men, loafing on welfare like they used to, talk about in the 70s or something like that. It's just mostly women and kids. And are there some people scamming? I'm sure. There's scams in every institution.
But people need assistance.
Yeah. And
we owe the citizens of this country assistance.
Yeah. And if we can't provide a system that has income for everyone, and a good income from somebody, I guess it's behooven upon us to provide other ways, particularly since the majority of people, I believe, the vast majority of people on welfare are either children, single mothers of those children, disabled or elderly.
You know what really honks my horn is, for example, people who think that people on welfare should be drug tested. There's always some people post these things on Facebook. If you think that they should be drug tested, that is just such an insult.
Yeah, why don't they drug test the banksters?
Yeah.
That's who robbed us. All right, thanks a lot. Appreciate your call. Let's see here. Where are we in the stack of things? I'm going to get Kenneth. Kenneth is in Southfield. Hi, Kenneth. You're on the air.
Oh, hi, Peter, Jelaine.
Hi.
Hi, Kenneth.
I'm a big fan of your show.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Peter, on the topic of the wars, I think Obama's been doing a pretty reasonable job with considering all the trouble he came into. And most of the time I'm anti-war, and I'm against all these conflicts. I think we should come out of Afghanistan really soon. And with Libya, I think that maybe he's trying to encourage democracy over there, since has been a lot of protests over in Libya lately.
Well, but Kenneth, that's not really the issue. The issue is the American Constitution, which says only Congress shall declare war in order to, taking into account the modern world. The Congress in 1973, as I'm sure you know, passed the War Powers Act, which put certain obligations upon the president. And Obama has ignored those. I mean, he's got this insane rationalization that this is not hostilities, which people say. Just ask the people in Libya. And it's not so much whether we should be helping the rebels or not, but it has to do with the nature of constitutional rule in this country that was eroded tremendously by George W. Bush, who believed in this unitary president. You got to remember, as I was saying last week, the founding fathers were frightened, very much so, because of their experiences from Europe, of having a strong central government. And what they wanted was the Congress to be the real power, the executive simply to carry out the laws that they passed. So again, the concern is not as much of the legitimacy of aiding the Libyan rebels, although we don't know why the United States wouldn't be supporting the Syrian rebels and the Bahrainian rebels and the few Saudi rebels that there are. So yeah,
that's sad to see those in Syria. I think he should put out some kind of threat to them. They need to stop that. They're just mowing down those people.
Yeah, they are.
Mm-hmm.
They are. It was, you know, and it's funny, too. They both Gaddafi and Assad in Syria have tremendous support also among the people. They had a demonstration in Syria, in Damascus, where they had this flag that was like miles long. Held up by hundreds of thousands of people.
That's amazing.
And I saw on television tonight they had Gaddafi says he's going to arm 1 million people to defend Tripoli against, talk about a civil war. And they showed these like middle-aged women shooting these Kalashnikovs up in the air.
Oh my gosh!
Yeah, don't those things come down?
The Kalashnikov.
Kalashnikov. You say. What is that? All right. Thank you very much, Kenneth. Appreciate it. What's the other thing? The AK-47.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that little delight.
Yeah. Is there a difference between the Kalashnikov and the AK? No, I think that's the same
thing.
They're
kind of the same. Well, one's Russian and...
No, they're both Russian. It was, I think... Okay. Gun nuts, you can do some good.
Lars, where are you?
Yeah. That I think AK was the initials of the Russian inventor of it. So it was A. Kalashnikov. And it was Model 47.
What we learn, the things we learn.
But, I mean, I could be wrong. So we will. Hey, here's, I can't remember. I can't do this. I got to reach
over
here.
Come on over, Peter.
Yeah, I'm getting this call because it is Bob in Big Rapids, where I went to school. Hey, Bob. How you doing?
How you doing there?
What?
How you doing?
We're good. Are you listening online?
Yes, I am.
Oh, okay. Well, good. Welcome. You're on the air.
Appreciate it. I'm also a student here. I lived in Japan for about 20 years, and I was in the military for 10 of those. And the reason I gave you guys a call is I want to talk to you about the socialized medicine.
Sure.
Because I've heard a lot of people say that socialized medicine won't work. There's big problems with it. Of course, with any adjustment in any society, I mean, you're going to see some kind of backlash no matter what. But I think that the benefits overall would be astronomical compared to the problems we have now with medical.
Of course.
Mm-hmm.
It works well in every other country.
Every other industrialized nation in the world.
Yeah.
Right. I mean,
you knew that.
I mean, I was a foreign alien living there, and I had full medical coverage for like $50 a month.
Wow.
And I come back here, and I can't even get medically insured.
Yeah.
I mean, we're trying to go through the social medicine here, or whatever you call it, the welfare or whatever it is.
Medicaid.
And, oh, my God. What a nightmare.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's an indignity, too, because people in the other countries, like Japan and Canada and everywhere else, take it as a matter of citizenship. Like, in other words, we wouldn't say, well, wait a minute, you didn't pay for the police this year, so although there's somebody breaking into your house, we're not saying, oh, your house is on fire, you didn't pay for the fire, sorry. Oh, sorry, you owe a couple thousand dollars for your kid for high school this year. We take all those things as a socialized. That is, you know, socialized, this was a phrase, socialized, although I think it's a good word, I accept it fully. The phrase socialized medicine was devised in, I don't know, either 1940s or 1950s by the American Medical Association, who at that time opposed a national health insurance program when it was introduced by the Democrats in the late 1940s. And so, but, and they, you know, this was, everybody was afraid of communism, everybody opposed socialism, and they said socialized medicine. Well, what that simply means, as I'm sure you realize, is the cost, rather than individuals having to come up with it, the cost is socialized. So we socialize the cost of teaching. So we have socialized education. We socialize the cost of police. So we, every neighborhood doesn't have to hire its own security guards.
Yeah.
So,
what about your, the roads?
All of it. Yeah. So all of that is socialized. We don't have, for instance, we should have socialized college education. It's no, I mean, it's insane that we have to put this kind of debt burden on families and, in most cases, on the students themselves. And it's like I say, it's, in this country, the, you know, culturally, it's thought of that if you have to accept assistance at certain levels, you're thought of as a failure. On the other hand, we don't think it's a failure when we call the police and they come right out, because that's socialized. If our house is on fire, same thing. We send our kids to school, that's socialized. Why in the hell should we, in one of the most critical services to human beings, that is healthcare, why do we have to make people, you know, if they don't have all the
money? Suffer, die.
Yeah, what do they think? 44,000 people a year die in this country because they don't have access to medical care.
Absolutely. And I mean, it's pointless. I mean, there should be no reason why we have that high of a mortality rate in this country.
Yeah, no. It's insane.
There should be no reason why we can't go ahead and do it. But, I mean, you have people on the other side of the fence, and they say, well, if they make it mandatory for everybody to be on a socialized medicine, well, then, you know, there's just a government trying to cram it down our throat. And I disagree with that. They just don't see the benefits of it.
Well, you know, with cram it down our throat, they could have, I suppose, some mixed system. I think they have some countries have like that. If you want
a lot of different ways.
Yeah, if you want to have private health plans like we have here, and you think that's better than the government plan, I think like in Switzerland, you know, you can go for it. But on the other hand, as a matter of taxpayers, like for instance, if I send my kids to a private school because I don't want to send them to public school, I can do that. But I still have to pay my, you know, the tax, the school tax.
Yeah. Right?
Yeah. Well, that's all. All right. What do you know? You go to school up there?
Yes, I do. I'm in Ferris State up here.
Yeah, me too. I went there. But I didn't get a degree. I didn't get a degree from it. I'm too ADD, too dyslexic, too what else? I was a troublemaker to put.
You were a wandering cat.
Yeah. All right, Bob. Thanks a lot. Appreciate your call. Let me see. Yeah, we got time. Let's see. Here's Brendan in Southgate. Hey, Brendan, you're on the air.
Here.
Oh, wait a minute. You know, I can't do that. Why can't I?
I will focus you.
Okay. Yeah.
Promise.
Hi, Brendan. You're on the air.
Hey, man.
There he is. Where you been, man?
I got some views on a few different topics that you had today, man.
What? Like what?
Like one, smoking cigarettes. Wait a sec. It's bad for you, man. It's bad, man. Don't do it, man. But you're illegalizing marijuana and pot.
Yeah.
That, you know, we might as well make some money off of it. Oh wow, man! Choked on that one.
Yeah,
do
you're
people
burning.
Still say "oh wow, man" after they take a hit?
Yeah.
Clearly, they do.
Hey, and what else are you talking about?
Gay marriage.
Gay marriage. Yeah. What up?
Gay marriage. Anybody wants to get married is gay, man. Let them do it, man.
But, I agree.
You know, yeah, it's okay. But, you know, the guys that live in their houses, man, the gay guys, keep their blinds pulled, man.
Oh, God.
Well, you could say that. You could say.
What are you looking in people's blinds for, Brendan?
But you could say that about anybody. That leads me on to another story. All right, Brendan. stay cool, dude.
Yeah.
Where is that story about...
What, Bristol Palin?
No, please. Don't even say that word. The woman who is being harassed by the Christian fundamentalist cop. Oh, here.
Oh.
Here it is. Didn't you get that?
Was that the judge?
This is an atheist in Central Florida filed suit in federal district court in Tampa on Friday accusing the Polk County Sheriff, an evangelical Christian, of harassing and unnecessarily arresting her as retaliation for not believing in God and for her efforts to keep prayer out of public meetings.
I mean, that's scary.
Ellen Beth Wachs, the
to be doing this.
Yeah, the legal coordinator for the group Atheists of Florida asked the court to prevent the sheriff, Grady Judd, from conducting any new investigations or arrests resulting from her non-religious atheist viewpoint in the predominantly Christian-oriented Polk County, Florida. The sheriff's action, including two arrests and searches of her house, violated her constitutional First Amendment rights and her right to due process, according to the suit. She's a vocal advocate for the separation of church and state, and Ms. Wachs has attended several school board meetings where sessions began with a prayer, clearly unconstitutional, I should say, and asked that a moment of silence be observed instead. The suit states the sheriff used scripture in the agency newsletter, among other things. I guess he just doesn't believe in the First Amendment. The imbroglio, wow, the dispute, in other words, between Miss Walk, who lives in Lakeland, and Sheriff Judd dates to last year when the sheriff removed the basketball hoops from the Polk County Jail and donated them to several local churches.
Oh, my God.
What a piece of work guy. She may be as well, but, you know.
Who voted for this guy? Well, it's a very, where she lives, it's a very Christian town.
Now, the fact that he did this, I mean, he took actually county property and gave it to churches. But anyways, this angered Ms. Wachs, who filed several public records requests on the matter. A non-practicing lawyer, she signed the request with the designation Esquire after her name, ESQ, which is for lawyers. Mm-hmm. Sheriff Judd sent a squad of officers to arrest her and charged her in March with illegally posing as a lawyer, a felony. Her lawyer said this doesn't violate any bar rule. She is allowed to use Esquire. Ms. Wachs was arrested for a second time in May for moaning repeatedly in a sexual manner from an open window in her house, saying, "Oh, John! Oh, John!"
She's kind of fun.
In a crescendo, as a ploy to stop neighbors, including a young boy, from playing basketball. Maybe he had the hoops from the sheriff. I don't know. The moans followed a dispute with the neighbor. The sheriff's officer arrested her on a felony sex charge. The police
moaning? Oh, my God.
Get this, though. The police searched her house and took away a safe, among other things. Last month, the police arrested her again, charged her with possession of marijuana after saying they had found drugs in the safe. Mm-hmm. The sheriff's office declined to comment on the lawsuit. Her lawyer said, "We are asking a federal judge to put a stop to this madness. We want to try to stop a rogue sheriff who is abusing his authority as a law enforcement officer to punish a vocal atheist in town for her viewpoint and political beliefs."
Well, what a story that is. And then did you hear about NBC? They had to apologize because apparently it was an on-air apology during the U.S. Open, I guess.
Yeah.
The network opened its broadcast with a montage that included children reciting the pledge, but the words "under God" and "indivisible" were omitted. It was probably just the way it was edited.
Yeah.
And people on social media went crazy. I mean, like, immediately went crazy calling for a boycott of NBC, and then they, of course, had to apologize. What a bunch of crap.
Yeah, that wasn't even in the original. Well, "indivisible" was. That was the whole thing. It was when you pledge allegiance, that throws in the toilet. In fact, we'll talk about it a little more when we come back. That throws in the toilet the whole idea that, for instance, the state of Texas wants to put the Confederate flag on their license plates.
Oh, and before, because we're going to a break, right? I was at the Downriver Cruise yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
Could not believe how many Confederate flags went by me. It was awful.
The flags? The flag of the greatest traitors in American history.
Horrible.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Julene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Let your opinion be heard. Call us at 313-298-WRIF.
Whatever's going on, it seems to be far from over.
Peter and Julene will be taking more of your calls right after this.
We know you love to save money. That's why we know you'll love MotorCityDailyDeal.com. Each weekday, MotorCityDailyDeal.com sends an unbelievable deal right to your inbox. We're working with local businesses to make sure these deals save you 50 to 85% off. Restaurants, salons, spas, events, and more. You get incredible deals from great local businesses like these:
Pinnacle Tech in Shelby Township, American Home Fitness in Sterling Heights, Storage Pros in Farm Farmington Hills, and Zumba with Ivy in Detroit.
And these deals are so good, they're only available for 24 hours. That's right, just 24 hours, then they're gone. MotorCityDailyDeal.com. It's your new local way to save on all the cool things you love to eat, see, and do. Log on, sign up, and save with MotorCityDailyDeal.com. That's MotorCityDailyDeal.com. MotorCityDailyDeal.com.
How do you get the most satisfaction? For some career-minded people, it's when they work toward a goal and reach it. The same may apply to you when preparing for your career. In fields like electronics technology, information technology, and drafting and design, you need knowledge and skills to get started. That's why you should call ITT Technical Institute. At ITT Tech, you can develop knowledge and skills to pursue opportunities in a variety of career fields. Call 800-741-5123. ITT Tech's programs are designed to help you develop skills and knowledge to pursue your career interest. Classes and day or evening courses meet just a few days a week, and financial aid is available for those who qualify. So pick up the phone right now and call ITT Tech for more information. Call 800-741-5123. 800-741-5123. That's ITT Tech. 800-741-5123.
One little fish oil pill. You know, this powerful little pill is great for your heart, that it's great for your joints. It even has powerful benefits for your skin and brain function. But the fish oils of today are sadly incomplete because they don't contain the super antioxidant power of clinically proven krill oil that can increase joint comfort by 28% in just 7 days. Until now. Introducing the free bottle giveaway of Krill Omega 3 from Purity Products, our most powerful fish oil formula ever. The only thing our advanced Krill Omega 3 fish oil is missing is the price. Because right now, we're offering anyone a full-size bottle of our krill oil as part of a nationwide free trial. Just call 1-800-950-5868. To request yours, you can't go to stores. The only way to get your free bottle is to go to the phone. The number is 1-800-950-5868. Call now and claim your bottle absolutely free. 1-800-950-5868. That's 1-800-950-5868.
Betsy, look at these sweaters. They look amazing on our girls.
Maybe.
Come on. What's wrong?
Suzanne, I have no business being in the store. I should not be shopping. Things are really tight. We're behind on our mortgage.
Listen, Bill and I had the same problem, and we got some really great counseling, and it was free. I'm going to email you the information.
If you even think you may be in danger of foreclosure, call the National Foundation for Credit Counseling today at 866-687-6322 or visit MortgageHelpNow.org. Public service from the NFCC.
Is it time for a new roof? Call Sears Roofing. You can save $500 if you call right now. Just call 1-877-938-1414. Hurry, offer ends soon. Not available in all states. Installation provided by Sears Authorized Licensed Contractors. License information available upon request. Get your roofing job done right. Call Sears Roofing now. You can save $500. Call now. 1-877-938-1414. Sears.
Yes. We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF. Voice your opinion at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Here are Peter and Julie.
Thank you very much. This is our final segment, so do join us at 313-298-9743. Did you get that email up?
Yeah, and by the way, we're off next week.
Oh, yeah. So gee, we forgot to tell people.
So, yeah. We will miss you, but we'll be back. Chip wrote in and said, I know it's not a big deal, Peter, but the word you were looking for was automatic Kalashnikov, AK. He was a tanker who invented it, mass-produced it in 1947, is what he said.
Okay, we can't argue about facts, but I thought it was the A stood for the man's Russian first name, and 47 was the model, not the year.
Okay, I don't know, but you know,
Can't you Google it?
I can, but with many things, there are many stories.
Okay,
many
you're right.
Explanations.
Hey, by the way, we always want more Facebook fans, friends, and you can go to facebook.com/nightcall. We'll have the podcast from this show up by noon tomorrow. We've got all the little bugs out of it. Of course, we say that every week.
No, we really do.
We were talking about that NBC, because of editing for time, left out Under God, which was inserted in the 1950s purely as a Christian demand from churches and from people like Billy Graham and what have you. Really, no, it shouldn't be in the pledge and has no part of it. Inconsistent with the original pledge, which was actually written by a Christian minister, a socialist Christian minister. If you're
that's right.
Ready for that. And that man named Bellamy, can't remember his first name off the top of my head. But the other part and the most important.
It was Frank Bellamy.
You sure?
Yeah.
Because there was two Bellamy brothers.
That was like Bill Bellamy, that was a comedian.
Jim.
I think
Jim
it's Bellamy. Frank. Yeah. Is it Jim?
Frank. I don't know. Reverend Bellamy. And then he had a brother that wrote a famous utopian novel called Erewhon.
Okay.
Which was nowhere spelled backwards.
Peter, this said. Oh, yeah.
Okay,
it is,
go ahead.
Isn't it? According to Wikipedia, the AK-47 is a first developed in the Soviet Union by Mikhail Kalashnikov. It's officially known as Avtomat Kalashnikova. It is also known as Kalashnikov and AK, or in Russian slang, Kalash.
Yeah. What's the 47?
So, that's a good question. Because...
I think it was model 47.
It began... yeah, I think you're right.
Okay. All right.
Okay. Well, okay. We're a little closer.
Yeah. All right, we were talking about the idea that Texas might have a license plate with a Confederate flag on it, and it would honor veterans. Now, get this language, the war between the states. The power of words and the importance of it, the precision or lack of it, is always very telling.
How about the war to maintain racism
slavery.
And slavery in the South?
Yeah. Hillary Sheldon, who is an incredible speaker, is a guy. Hillary Sheldon, the head of the NAACP, said that the Civil War may not be something we want to celebrate. He says, when many look back at that history, we think about it in terms of secession, that we were seceding from the Union in the southern parts of the country. Many would view that, quite frankly, as treason, because they meant to actually destroy the existing government structure. But when we dig deeper, the issue becomes more offensive to many African Americans and those that sought freedom for those of darker skin in our country.
Thank you.
And it sure does. I mean, because of the desire of the South to maintain an economy based on slave labor, keeping human beings enslaved, selling them like they were cattle, they went to a war that created or caused 600,000 deaths, jillions more wounded, including my great-great-grandfather. It's one of the reasons I have no sympathy for anyone flying a rebel battle flag, of all things. But that's what it's all about. And how in the world these slave masters got the were able to dupe the average Southern male who had no stake whatsoever in slavery to fight and die for that bloody rag is so far beyond me. But it is just absolutely offensive. It is like in Germany if they were going to fly an SS flag or something like that.
Or the Nazi symbol.
Yeah, or the Nazi symbol. But a Nazi flag or an SS battle flag or something like that.
Peter, I was right.
What?
It was... Francis Bellamy.
Francis Bellamy.
Yeah.
Yeah. You said Frank.
Well, you know, I shortened it up.
You called him Frank.
He's an old pal.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Let's go onwards. And here is Fred. Fred's been waiting a long time in Detroit. Go ahead. Wait a minute. I got to push the button over here, don't I? Fred, hi. You're on the air.
Hi, you're having quite the time with those buttons, aren't you?
Yeah, they're winning.
Well, it's a computer. The deal.
So I have a computer screen here, and with my mouse, I just click the phone that you're on. But now I have to. But then there's also phone buttons on this big control board, and I got to stretch way across it.
It's pretty complex in here.
Yeah. But go ahead, Fred. You're on the air.
Well, I'm going to agree with you about the Kalashnikov, but somebody already. Straighten that out, you and Jolene, too. I was going to also say that as far as the Chicago heat wave, that was between 600 or 700 deaths.
So there was.
Okay.
Well, let me just bring people back up to speed on that, Fred. First thing in the show, we said the United States spends $20 billion a year on air conditioning for American troops in Iraq and Afghanistan. And I said there are hundreds of people who have lost their lives in heat waves in the United States. But, so go ahead.
Now, before you went on break, you mentioned, some of the greatest traitors in the life of this country.
The Southerners, yeah, the secessionists.
Right. Well,
yeah.
I want to point out a couple of other groups.
Okay, go ahead.
And I don't want to sound like an apologist for Obama. I think I've told you before, I'm about as disappointed in him and the Democrats as you are.
Okay.
But anyway, the Blue Dog Democrats and Log Cabin Republicans.
Yeah.
Now, I think that...
Wait, before you go any further, let me just tell people. The Log Cabin Republicans are gay Republicans, and it would be like Jewish Nazis or something like that.
I don't get it.
And the Blue Dog Democrats are the conservative Democrats who might as well be Republicans for how they vote.
We're moderate. We're in between.
So go ahead. Sorry.
Well, I was just going to say that I think that had it not been for the Blue Dogs, for instance, Obama would have gotten the size stimulus package he needed to get this country moving and moving quicker.
Right.
I think Dodd would have gotten the kind of financial reform through he wanted. I think we would have gotten even if it wasn't a full national health care thing, we would have gotten a much better deal than what we got. And I don't think that the banks would be able to balk at Obama and homeowners the way they do if, the Democrats had had more power.
Well,
I don't know who all these people are in the midterm elections who put all these conservatives back in power.
Well, people stayed home.
Yeah, I think that's, Jelena is absolutely right. I think it's mostly a case of people staying home. And if the Republicans are dumb enough to put one of these whack jobs up like Michelle Bachmann or Palin or the pizza guy, what's his name? What's the pizza guy?
I don't know. I just heard about him on the way here. I can't remember.
What's the pizza guy's name?
Was it the black guy?
Yeah.
Or something, I forget.
Anyway, they put him up, and that's
he's really making waves. Yeah, you can tell.
That's who the Democrats are hoping for, you know, because they'll just run all over him. People, and you know, if people like me and probably you, Fred, if we see Michelle Bachmann, we'll go, ah,
she's so scary.
What do you think about this? You know, I said this to a couple of friends at breakfast today, and they were appalled that I said it. Here, I said, was the best combination, and I'm not even necessarily saying next year, but maybe, you know, like in 4 years from next year. The president, no, don't shriek, let me finish. Ron Paul for president and a completely Democratic Congress. That way, here's a guy that wants Ron Paul, the Republican, the Libertarian, wants to, you know, get rid of all these drug laws. He wants to take end all these wars. He wants to take, these hundreds and hundreds of foreign bases back. He wants to repeal the Patriot Act. But then he says people ought to be able to just take care of themselves when it comes to medicine. Or he wants to let the states determine abortion. Well, the Democrats would be in there to stop that. So that might be a hell of a combination.
Peter.
Yeah.
Peter, he's sitting there with a grin on his face. He does not mean that. And hey, did you see they said Bachmann and Romney are neck and neck? I just laughed.
They're neck and neck.
That's what there was some poll that they were neck and neck.
Oh, this is not actually.
No. You mean,
you're like in a horse race.
Oh, God.
All right, Fred. Thank you so much. I appreciate your call. Here is here's Michael, and Michael is from Jackson, and the way it says it up on the board, Michael, it says Michael Jackson, but go ahead.
Well, yesterday was the anniversary of his death. Yeah.
Hello?
Yeah.
Go ahead, Michael, you're on the air.
Hello, Peter, you're a smart guy. I wanted to ask your opinion and perception about President Obama.
Yeah.
This guy obscurely came out of nowhere. He's such a blank slate. And I'm trying to figure out, is he a principled man that just kind of plays the political game to achieve the ends of what he wants to accomplish, or is he just a con artist?
Well, you know what? I think he's a consummate politician. He's a centrist. He, you know, that Maureen Dowd, who's a few...
He's kind of like a Bill Clinton.
Well,
of sorts.
Well,
kind of a little bit in the middle, like you said.
Yeah, and he always wants it both ways. I mean, he won't take these heavy principled stands that are necessary, that he hasn't provided the kind of leadership for the kind of values he says he espouses. And I guess I think he probably does, but You know, you don't go golfing with
Boner?
John Boehner. Boner. Yeah, I'm sorry, mispronounced his name. So I don't think he's a con artist. I think he's a politician. Right now, he's trying to figure out how can he get reelected. I mean, one of the hopes of the Democrats is that once he can get by this 2012 election and get reelected, then he'll start, doing
standing
whatever.
Up, doing things that we wish he would do.
I hope so. All right. Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Let's see. Here is Lusado. Is that, am I saying your name correctly?
Hello?
Hello. Hi. You're on the air. Is this, am I saying your name correctly, Lusado?
No, Ricardo.
Ricardo.
Ricardo, okay.
It's a combination of Ricky Ricardo and most people.
I know the name Ricardo. It said Lusado down. I guess they misheard you.
L-U-C-A-D-O.
It is.
Oh, it is Lusado.
Yeah.
All right.
Okay, hi.
It's a combination of Lucy and Ricky. I love it.
That's awesome.
Yeah, for my mom, she's Puerto Rican.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
But I have, huh?
That's awesome. Great name.
Thank you. I'm 47 years old and also a gay man. And there's a couple of comments I wanted to make. And I'm short-time listener, first-time caller.
Welcome.
Yeah.
Thank you. I have a question. One question. I was watching the news tonight, and I worked for the Detroit City of Detroit 15 years in recreation, 10 years for the city council. And I left with someone else that left last couple of years ago. I can't say her name, but you know who it was.
Yeah.
SC. But my company is John. What's his name? That old man need to go home and relax in the nursing home.
Hey, John Conyers?
Oh, yes. John. Oh, yeah.
Yes.
So what are you saying? You were going to run against him?
No, he needs to go home.
He's doing
he
a lot of good
things.
He
needs to go home and count his little money before his wife gets out and take the rest of it.
Well, yeah.
He's actually doing a lot of really good things.
Well, he has voted pretty well. He's a good stalwart for a lot of the... And you said you were Puerto Rican. I think there's a couple of Puerto Rican friends of mine listening, Julio and Kike. So
hello.
If you guys are still up, hello to you. But we're going to have to sort this one out some other time, Lusado. Okay, here is Johnny in Woodhaven. Johnny, hi, you're on the air. Whoop, wait a minute, sorry. Go ahead, you're on the air.
There you go.
Hey, happy night, Peter and Jeline.
Thank you.
Happy night.
I've been tossing around with my buddies for a while about as far as why I think law enforcement's so paranoid about the Marijuana Act. And
why they're so what?
Paranoid?
Why they're so paranoid. Well, you know, just think about it. You know, they got the test for booze and beer. And think about how you're going to know if, you know, somebody burned one like 2 or 3 hours ago. I mean,
they're finding ways.
By the way, they got tests for that.
If
you burned one a day ago, they can tell. Are the police drug tested?
No. Oh, the drug tested? I'm sure they are. Sure they are.
See, what I'm thinking is, like, I know that Michigan, I think it was the Supreme Court or something a few months back, they said that you basically, if you got it in your system, doesn't necessarily mean you're high because it stays in your system for 2 or 3 weeks. Whereas, you know, that's a blood test, you know. Whereas, let's say, you know, you just burned one 3 hours ago, but you're not really buzzed, and it will be in your system in blood saying that you're high, but you're technically not buzzed. You know you're not.
Mm-hmm. Well, the thought is, particularly with the police, that since they're technically always on duty, that they shouldn't be violating Michigan law. I mean, that's one thing. The other thing is it would make me nervous if a pilot was going to be a pilot of my flight and he tested positive for marijuana, even though he wasn't,
according to him, stoned
at the time. Wow, man, look, we're going straight down.
Ooh, wow.
Look at that truck down there.
That's not what weed does to people, though. Come on. I mean, it's not, you know what I mean? People have this idea that that's what it is, but I would say you'd be a lot more high on a drink.
Well, yeah, for sure. All right, Johnny, thank you very much. Appreciate your call. Here is, this is Tristan. Tristan's in Dearborn. Hi, Tristan, you're on the air.
Hey, Peter, Julian, how you all doing tonight?
Good, what's up?
Hey, you guys were talking about healthcare and that a little bit ago.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And personally, this is just my view on it. I think the only reason they won't go to a socialist healthcare system is because there's too many people in government that have ties to the big business that are keeping their pockets laden with money.
Oh, sure.
Well, there's that. That's a given,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, but you know what? The conservatives, I know you're not going to believe I'm saying this, Tristan, but the conservatives are right. This is just the thin wedge. This is the opening for what will eventually be Medicare for all. I mean, if we said, nobody except these crazy right-wing Republicans wants to get rid of Medicare for our seniors, but, so it starts at 65. So what if you said, how about if we did it for 64? I don't think that would upset people too much. What about 63? Well, you could start getting it down farther and farther until the point where what about when you're 1 year old?
Kind of like the Republicans would like to raise the retirement age a year up to like 68 or something.
Yeah, yeah. So, but right now, we probably can't afford it as long as we do not require the revenue from the people that have this enormous amount impacted wealth, that these corporations that are making these enormous profits, the banks and the oil companies that are gouging us. Did I say the wars? Probably
you didn't.
The wars and all that. Yeah. Well, I mean, we can't even afford to keep teachers on or keep our city governments open 5 days a week. So not much is possible as long as we're not taking in the money that we should, and the money that we're spending is all in the wrong manner. And the wrong manner is not government workers' pensions or, stuff like that.
Okay. The list goes on and on.
Yes. Thank you so much.
Yes,
and,
thank you.
Here is somebody that's been kind of in the kind of fell through the cracks. My apologies. Scott from Westland. Hi, Scott. You're on the air.
Hi, Pete. Hi, Jillian. Actually, I get to talk about something that I've had some firsthand experience with. Under Governor Snyder, apparently the Department of Natural Resources has announced an auction of public land held by the DNR, including Lake Michigan waterfront.
Oh, what?
Now, I could see that this is some way of maybe, paying down the deficit or something like that, but I only know about this basically what I saw in a little banner headline on a local news channel. They run the news, under the temperature, time and the temperature there.
Yeah.
First of all, I would have to say that, under the Michigan Wetland Protection Act, basically they froze development of all Great Lakes waterfront in Michigan. So I can't remember the exact distance. It's like 100 feet. Maybe it's 500 feet. But everything within, say, 100 feet or 500 feet of Lake Michigan and Lake Huron and Lake Superior, too, in the state of Michigan is protected as a wetland, which means that you can't really develop any more Great Lakes lakefront. And that's critical because that needs to be managed for fish and wildlife, basically.
And you think, and now under Snyder, they're talking about getting rid of this? This is horrible. They're trying to sell off government property in Greece to pay down the debt from, this is what the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund is doing. And those folks are rioting in the street to protect their national assets. I'm not saying we should do it.
Even the dogs are rioting over
Even
there.
The dogs are rioting. All right. Thank you very much, Scott, for that heads up. Now, hey, are you going to join us? There's going to be a rally at the corner of 9 Mile and Woodward in Ferndale at 4:45 tomorrow.
Today, afternoon.
Monday afternoon, right. And it's going to say President Obama taking out 10,000 troops is not enough. We no longer want to waste our federal treasury, our tax dollars, the money we earned on this rat hole of a war.
And $20 billion in air conditioning a year.
Bring all the troops home now. If you want more information, go to my website, Peter Werbe, WERBE.com. Athena, Sarah, thank you so much for doing all that.
Yeah.
Listeners and callers. Hey, got a couple of great interviews and going to start with this kind of history of San Francisco. Wow, I love
Groovy, man.
When you go to San Francisco,
you leave your heart there.
And wear flowers in your hair?
Yeah, groovy.
Jillian, we'll talk next week.
Okay.
Oh, no, we won't. We won't be here.
No, we won't, actually.
We're off. Read my website, Peter Werbe, WERBE.com.
We'll be back.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with more Night Call right after this.
Homeowners, how do you find the right contractor when you want something built? How do you find the best service professional when you need something fixed? For any type of service for your home, go to the most trusted website for pre-screened home pros. Just go to fixitfast.servicemagic.com. Service Magic is a free online resource that instantly connects you with pre-screened remodelers, maids, repairmen, and many other home contractors. If you need a plumber, electrician, painter, or any other home pro, visit fixitfast.servicemagic.com. It's easy and it's free, and it's the smartest way to find neighbor-rated contractors in your area. Over 10 million homeowners have trusted Service Magic for their home improvement and maintenance projects. So hire a pre-screened home pro with confidence. Go to fixitfast.servicemagic.com. fixitfast.servicemagic.com. That's fixitfast.servicemagic.com.
Are you ready to do something about your high credit card debt? Tired of paying double-digit interest rates, late fees, over-limit fees? It's time to stop the madness. Get out of debt the safe and affordable way with Credit Card Relief. With Credit Card Relief, there are no upfront fees, no monthly maintenance fees, and no settlement fees. You don't pay anything until a debt is settled, all with a 90-day money-back guarantee. That's Credit Card Relief, managed by local attorneys in-state, with workout plans tailored to your debt situation. Get out of debt in months instead of years, all while saving thousands in future bank fees. Call the original Credit Card Relief, where the consultation is free and the results are real.
Call 866-290-8282. Not available in all states. That's Credit Card Relief. 866-290-8282. 866-290-8282. Do you have a disability that prevents you from working? Then you may be entitled to collect thousands of dollars of Social Security benefits. If you've been medically disabled for at least 12 months and previously worked 5 of the last 10 years, you may qualify to receive thousands of dollars paid directly to you every month. Just call Disability Benefits Alliance at 1-877-941-8822. Disability Benefits Alliance can cut through government red tape and help you receive Social Security disability.
Hey, Larry, mind if I sit down?
Nope.
This coffee tastes like coffee. So what's going on?
Not much.
What's new?
Not much.
Okay, but can you please put the newspaper down while you say not much?
What newspaper?
This newspaper. Oh, dude, what happened to your face? I see 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
Ow.
Dude, what is this? 11 pieces of toilet paper stuck to your face?
I'm shaving in the dark to save energy. I'm helping the environment.
Well, that's a dangerous way to help the environment.
Well, sometimes you have to sacrifice yourself for the greater good.
Dude, there's an easier and safer way to help the environment without sacrificing yourself. Go green, go public. Take public transportation. It's good for the environment and you won't have to live behind a newspaper.
Wow.
But for now, put the newspaper back up.
A message from the public transportation systems across the country. To learn more, visit publictransportation.org.
All day today, score the ultimate ticket package, including Motley Crue this Wednesday at DTE. And for Mayhem Festival featuring Disturbed August 6th at DTE. Plus, one lucky winner will go backstage to meet Nikki Sixx in person. Motley to Mayhem Monday. Listen and win every hour all day today from 101 WRIF. Everything that rocks. 101 WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit.
We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werby here with you. Yeah, I just saw this Woody Allen film, Midnight in Paris. One of the themes was, what era is the best era to live in? And the character in Midnight in Paris wants to live back in the 20s. And then people in the 20s want to live back in the 1890s. And so the message was, hey, things are good right where you are. But you know, some decades were more interesting and more exciting and more creative than others. I mean, it's not to diss any particular favorite decade of yours, but of course the 60s always loom extraordinarily large, and there's been so much written, so much said about it. It's cultural, it's political, it's economic, it's creative end of things. It was just amazing. And the material is endless in terms of what can be mined to give us an understanding of that decade. And it's not just nostalgia to me. It, in many ways, gives us an idea of what can be replicated, the best of it. And contrary to what some people say, I think the vast majority of it was pretty darn good. So there's a book out from City Lights, that wonderful publisher. You can go to citylights.com. It's called 10 Years That Shook the City, San Francisco, 1968 to 78. And you say, whoa, wait a minute. That's almost at the end of the 60s, but we can talk about that as well. With the editor of a series of first-person and historical essays that span that decade from 68 to 78. So my guest is Chris Carlson. He's put this together with Lisa Ruth Elliott, and we join Chris Carlson at his home in San Francisco. Hi, Chris. Welcome to the Peter Werby Show.
Thanks, Peter. Great to be on the radio with you.
So, is this officially the 60s? A lot happened in San Francisco prior to 1968. Why did you choose that particular decade?
60? Yeah, we're actually kind of really reframing it as what happened in the wake of the 60s. I mean, obviously, there's a lot of arguments all around the sociological, anthropological, and political spectrums about what we're talking about in that era. You know, the long 60s is commonly invoked, which might run anywhere from 57 to 60 to 74 or something like that. And I don't disparage those frames. Those are fine. But for our purposes in San Francisco, which was, it's a book that really looks hard at the social upheavals and explosions that took place in the city. And there's certainly plenty of things that happened before 68 that influenced the stories that are told in the book. And many of the essays inevitably have to back up, including my introduction to the book, and talk about some of those earlier antecedents. But nevertheless, the focus we took was that decade, precisely because it's a decade of great interest to me. I came to San Francisco on the 1st of 1978, and I always had this kind of personal gnawing curiosity about, well, this world that I entered, how did it get to be that way? Why was it just the way it was? Who were those players? What had influenced them? And very difficult, typically, any of us, as we're first come of consciousness, you know, we're born in a certain time, and it's very difficult to get people to tell you about the history that really shaped your life, right where you came into it. So I had this kind of long-term curiosity about that decade, and then specifically there's two bookends in 68 and 78 that I thought really framed the history of San Francisco in a way that I've come to understand. I've been doing a history project now for the last 15, 17 years called Shaping San Francisco, which has multiple personalities. It's online, a big digital archive at foundsf.org. I do bicycle history tours in the city, and I also host a series of public discussions three times a month at an art space here called Counterpulse. And so this sort of ongoing multi-decade investigation that I've been involved in kept looping back to this era and seeing, meeting people today who are still involved in the city, shaping its politics, shaping its cultural expressions, shaping its institutions, and then hearing their stories and recognizing these important precedent-making experiences in their lives. So 1968, key moment, not only in the world, obviously it's a worldwide revolution in every sense of the word, all over the place, from Paris to Prague to Beijing to Mexico cities and all over the United States, and San Francisco is no exception. And one of the things that happened here is we had the largest strike in U.S. history in terms of a university, where both a faculty strike and a student strike. It was the longest lasting student strike in U.S. history, and it gave rise here, who's led by the Black Student Union and then the Third World Liberation Alliance. And those two entities, which comprised all the students of color at the time, really altered the scope of university education, not just in San Francisco State, but throughout the country, because it gave rise to Black Studies programs, ethnic studies programs of all sorts, actually created a school of ethnic studies at San Francisco State. Of course, all these things are under attack now, and many of them have already been shrunken and diminished, but it was a very important moment. But then out of that strike, and it was also an alliance with the faculty, and there was, you know, a much broader sort of rejection of the current government at the time was Ronald Reagan, the governor of California, and so on. A lot of details about that. But from that strike, so many of the people involved in it were, you know, student activists of various types who then migrated back into the struggles in the city. And the struggles in the city had to do with the reshaping of each neighborhood, particularly working-class neighborhoods here, which the federal program that created the possibility for municipal redevelopment agencies was incredibly influential here in San Francisco, and we had whole neighborhoods that were bulldozed. of what everybody loves now, our charming Victorian architecture. Well, there's certain parts of town where you don't see any of that because they tore it all down during this time. And the reason they tore it down was quite explicit. If you read the documentation and the literature coming from the Redevelopment Agency all the way back to the 40s when it was founded, it was too dark. You know, it was dingy. It was dilapidated. It was all blighted. These are the language that was used to describe neighborhoods in which basically working class communities had lived and reproduced themselves and were pretty much the place where people remembered, had participated in and remembered social struggles and how to win. So we had some massive moments in San Francisco history going back to, you know, a long way, but particularly famously the 1934 general strike.
Well, certainly then this is not a nostalgia book, although one can read it and find a lot of delight in the essays that comprise 10 years that shook the city. So we begin 1968, the year of the San Francisco State College strike and all of its implications, and then ends at 10 years later on some pretty tragic and dire circumstances.
Here we had, in San Francisco, we had the assassination of the mayor, Moscone, who had been elected partly through this broad left coalition that had emerged from all these social events that in the decade preceding, and of course Harvey Milk, the first gay supervisor. He's been quite well remembered in literature and cinema and everything else. And then within 9 days of that, the massacre in Jonestown, which is thought of, you know, properly so, as this madman, Jim Jones, and had managed to bring all these people with him to the jungles of Guyana. Well, where did he bring them from? Was San Francisco. And who were they here in San Francisco? They'd been the shock troops of left demonstrations. Like whenever you had any demonstration in town for the whole 10 years from 68 to 78, well, really, they didn't get going until the early 70s. But anyway, the last part of the 70s, you know, you might have 20, 30 people having a picket line in front of City Hall, and all of a sudden two buses pull up and outpour all these, you know, chanting, happy black women, you know, clapping and singing, who join your demonstration. And they were like the Jonestown people. They were from the Church of People's Temple is what it was known as. And it was a multiracial, socialist-oriented, more or less, you know, broadly accepting and tolerant church that was Christian for sure, but it was kind of loose about its orientation. And Jones was you know, a charismatic leader of it, and turned out to be quite insane.
What does that tell you, though? I mean, I guess conservatives would say in many ways that's the logical end of a left philosophy.
Or maybe somebody else might say it's the logical end of a kind of Christian messianic philosophy.
Yeah, well, that's, I think, what I would say.
That's kind of where I lean, too. But, you know, in any case, one of the essays in the book is called Coming Together, the Communal Option, and it's a survey of the rather wild panoply of strange cults and religious sects that emerged in San Francisco during that time, alongside a tremendous number of just communal experiments that had to do with reinventing daily life. So people banded together in the same beautiful old Victorian, sometimes living 14 to 20 people in a place that might today only house two families or even only one. And in those large assemblages of people, they would invent new ways of doing things. Another story that comes out of the book is about the people's food system, which was a lot of us today, especially in Northern California, maybe a little less so in Detroit. I was there last summer. It was a little harder to find this sort of gourmet revolution, quote unquote, that's been going on. But, you know, healthy food is emerging everywhere, and people are more concerned about organics. And there's a lot of stories in our book that really set the stage. Why do we have that big concern now? Well, because people started moving in that direction back then. And out of these household experiments in communal living came the food conspiracies, where people banded together in large numbers, you know, 15 to 100 people, and they would decide what food they wanted to get, and then they would send somebody off to the directly to the farmers, either at a nearby farmer's market or right out into the California Central Valley, and buy in huge quantities, you know, potatoes and rice and carrots and everything else you could buy in large quantities directly from the farmer, and bring it back, divide it up, and everybody would get their food at wholesale cost. And that worked pretty well for a few years, and there was really thousands of people involved in these conspiracies. They had all sorts of different names, like the Movable Feast, or there's another one about they're for escaping my memory, but anyway, things about picnics, you know, and all kinds of fun names. And then some of them felt sort of that typical guilt of that era about the working class. Like a lot of folks were on welfare, or they were having, you know, parents' money, and it was cheap to live in San Francisco in those days, if you can imagine that. So they didn't have to spend a lot of money to be here, and they had found ways to really reduce that even further. And now there's a sense, but, you know, working class people can't do this. We should be providing for them, you know, because they have to go to work all day. They don't have time to work on them, providing they're going to get the food and dividing it up and spending all these hours doing that. So some folks decided to start a store and create a cheap, healthy, relatively wholesale-priced food store direct to the public. And that led to a profusion of those, and there ended up being around 13 or 14 of them, and that was known as the People's Food System, and they had this whole, you know, multiple warehouses. They had dozens of collectives, the Red Cheese Collective for cheese. They had veritable vegetables. There was a women's collective to repair refrigeration units, all kinds of different things. And they shared warehouse space, a lot of it right here in the Mission District where I live today. And so this explosion we have of gourmet foods and organic, you know, whole foods and things like that can be directly traced back to that social upheaval of around the question of food. And then if you want to trace it even more interestingly backwards to, you know, sort of loop it back into a discussion of class and working class politics, it turns out it was the United Farm Workers Union that had a great deal to do with starting to this sort of grassroots movement, because what they did in the wake of their big strike in 65 in Delano in Central Valley, California, they went out on a grape boycott. Many people remember the famous United Farm Workers grape boycott. And what that led to was thousands of people all over the country standing in parking lots of large supermarkets talking to working class and middle class Americans coming in to buy their food and saying, please don't buy the grapes. Well, why not? Well, because the farm workers are asking you not to, because they're on strike against these growers and trying to get a decent living wage. But even more important, they made this the central issue, is they're being sprayed by DDT, by chemical, you know, known carcinogenic chemicals that are not only spraying on the workers, but they're spraying it on your food.
Well, we soon find out that all these issues are linked in together. The book is 10 Years That Shook the City, San Francisco, 1968 to 1978. My guest on the Peter Werbe Show is the editor, Chris Carlson, who's put this all together with Lisa Ruth Elliott. And you can go to citylights.com and do a search there, as I did. And also there'll be a direct link on my website, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E, .com. Chris, tell us about San Francisco itself. Now, most countries have some central cities, and, you know, like Paris and London, and in the United States, it's New York, and San Francisco isn't huge. We often say if it wasn't for the brain drain of people coming out of Detroit going to San Francisco, Detroit probably would have retained its reputation as the Paris of the Midwest. Why did it all happen in San Francisco?
That's an interesting
question. Well, that's a hard one. I'm saying, you know, what if somebody asked you that? I was thinking, I couldn't answer it. But
yeah.
What do you think? I mean, what was the allure? I mean, there's sort of a snowball effect, of course.
Yeah, well, like I, you know, it's interesting. I've been doing local history for quite a few years now, and I that question tends to haunt all of that kind of work, that kind of an inquiry, because so many unusual and trend-setting things have happened here over in its entire life. I mean, first of all, San Francisco is a very young city, really. It didn't even exist in 1845, and then it totally existed by 1850. So suddenly it came out of nowhere, you know, with the gold rush and the seizure of California by the U.S. Army, you know, in the Mexican-American War, et cetera. So there's a sort of birth story that's very odd, and, of course, the city was about 90% male from the beginning. And it was also at the far edge of the continent, and it has all this kind of mystique around going to the West Coast to get away from your life and reinvent yourself in a completely new way. And though there's a great deal of sort of self-congratulatory myth involved in San Francisco's self-conceptions even today, you know, where there's supposedly this bubble of leftism in this right-wing country and all these kind of fantasies, which actually we're not. You know, we're run by large corporations and very old, wealthy, elite white families like everywhere else in the United States. But nevertheless, there's also the case that people come here over and over again, wave after wave, especially at post-World War II, to change the world politically, change the world artistically, change the world of literature, change the world of music. There's something that really attracts people who want to experiment, who want to try to break out of the staid patterns of daily life as imposed by sort of the fantasy of American life. And really see that there's another way of doing things and find like-minded individuals who want to share those aspirations and really work on things together and actually, you know, sometimes the thought of San Francisco is a bunch of loafers and bums who just hang around and take welfare and don't do anything. It's far from the case. I mean, we do know how to live well and how to enjoy our lives, and there's a lot of hedonism here, both of the healthy variety as well as some of the more excessively unhealthy varieties. But nevertheless, there's this kind of passion for living that has informed the city. And then it's situated in this incredibly beautiful place. And the legacy of social struggles around the environment, which we do document in the book to a great extent, but they actually go back a great deal further. You know, the Sierra Club and John Muir date back to the 1890s and Save the Redwood Leagues and things like that to the early part of the 20th century and the whole conservation movement. But the conservation movement goes through a crucial change during this period in our book in 68 to 78. And it stops being a movement of sort of patrician, elder, property-owning white folks all over the open spaces around the area, which they're never going away. They're here, they're still there, and they still are a major backbone for certain parts of the environmental movement. But their work, in fact, they got to credit them, is like part of the stuff that they did in terms of saving open spaces, creating green belts, locking up lots of local lands into parklands forever and ever, stopping the Bodega Bay nuclear power plant that was being built on the San Andreas earthquake fault back in the early 60s. The freeway revolt in San Francisco in the early 60s has everything to do with why the city is as beautiful as it is today. We stopped having the city crisscrossed by these eight-lane freeways.
You know, I'm wondering whether, you know, all of a sudden I'm thinking, gee, I mean, they're going to be listening to Chris Carlson and more people are going to leave.
Yeah, come on out. We've got plenty of room.
before, I mean, this era and the city are so fascinating that, we don't have a tremendous amount of time. We should talk a little more about the book. I mean, in fact, it has color posters from the rock and roll era, comics, a lot of photography. It's a very nice job.
Yeah, we've
job
got
here
of that for sure. There's some beautiful photographs from Stephen Reese, who was a photographer of the anti-Vietnam War movement. Of course, the cover image itself is a picture of a vastly, incredibly huge demonstration of probably 250,000 people marching on Geary Boulevard in San Francisco, which today I can tell you never happens. You never see anybody marching on that street today. So it's an impressive photograph from just the sheer scale of it. And the other photos inside are more personal documentary or oriented around people they knew, he and the other guys that were working on this GI anti-war newspaper called Up Against the Bulkhead. It was actually for the Navy. And that was just one of several hundred papers around the country that were extant at the time that had everything to do with stopping the Vietnam War. I mean, people sort of have all kinds of arguments about how the war stopped. Of course, the Vietnamese get a great deal of credit for winning their war, but why did the U.S. Army fail as badly as it did? Well, because there was a massive mutiny within it, and they refused to fight. And this has, you know, been carefully swept under the rug all these years, and of course shifting to a volunteer army has made that easier to do.
Well, tell us about in terms of the essays. I mean, you've been an astute observer in your own life in San Francisco and also digging out the history of all the essays that you edited for 10 years that shook the city. Were there ones that surprised you that, you know, like, oh, or I didn't know that, or I didn't know it had that interpretation?
Yeah, there's the one that really jumps out at me with that question is one by Dr. Jason Ferreira. He's a very young guy. He teaches out at San Francisco State, and he wrote a piece called Los Siete, the Black Panthers, and Third Worldism in San Francisco. It has something about, I forget the title, I don't have it in front of me, but something about a rainbow in the title. And that one, the Soul of the Human Rainbow, I think is the title. And his piece does a really beautiful job of going back into the experience from those activists at the state strike and then how they moved out into the communities, into the Mission District, into the Fillmore, the Black Fillmore District. The Mission's, of course, Latino. The struggle around the International Hotel in San Francisco, a very seminal struggle for these elderly Filipinos. It was the last building standing of what had been a Filipino neighborhood. It took 10 years. That was a big sort of focal point for a lot of activism, particularly amongst radical Asian Americans. And all these different groups had different kinds of third worldist identities, but what his description does, what his analysis shows, is that the notion of third worldism emerged here organically, not as some kind of salute to or embrace of somebody else's iconic struggle in Mozambique or Central America, wherever, although some of those things happened later, but in the daily life that people had, the material experience of growing up in San Francisco in one or another of these ethnic communities and finding themselves confronted by a white racist police department that would shake them down on the streets, that would take them into the police stations and beat them up, that wouldn't give them any space to even gather in a normal, so-called freedom of assembly possibilities. They all shared a very common experience, and then they found each other in these common struggles. whether they were around the question of the redevelopment agency or bulldozing neighborhoods or fighting for, you know, affordable housing or trying to resist evictions or fighting for some kind of access to higher education at State, where there was this whole Third World Alliance, or also at UC Berkeley brought that together, as well as a junior college down the peninsula in San Mateo. So you had these shared struggles, and out of those shared struggles, not only shared struggles, but a lot of these kids went to high school together. They knew each other from high school. There's only like 8 high schools in San Francisco. There's not that many. And so people knew each other already, and they had romances with each other across their various ethnic groups, and then they would ride the same buses. There's one bus line here in San Francisco, the 22 Fillmore, that runs the whole spine of the city. And if you ride that bus from one end to the other, you go through every neighborhood of every different group. And people would do that because they just had to get from one place to another quite often. So out of all these shared experiences grew this idea of sort of a third world identity, and it wasn't this sort of outward-looking thing about other people's struggles who you're supposedly in support of, which, you know, again, that happened and it came along as time went on. But at the beginning of it, it was based on actually the life they had here in San Francisco. So that was, I thought, extremely refreshing, because we've come to a point, you know, 40 years later, where the balkanization of identity and struggles has become so profound, and so many people, especially in the Bay Area, are so kind of wrapped up in their, white guilt is a really dominant feature here, and it's immobilized tons of people because they're constantly being held in check by their fear of stepping on somebody's toes or, you know, reasserting some sort of a permanent, you know, hierarchical authority or whatever it might be. But in that time, everybody was welcome. It was an embrace of a shared identity, embrace of a class-aware struggle, because it was very class-based. They understood that they were all shared this experience because of their class position more than their ethnic position. And the ethnic identity certainly fueled their sensibilities, but it wasn't because of their ethnicity that they were in the situation they were in. It was because of their class position.
Let me, I'm sorry to interrupt you, I just want to make sure we get one final thing, because we're almost out of time with Chris Carlson and 10 years that shook the city, San Francisco, 1968, 1978. In that year, 1978, someone born in that year would be 33 years old today. They're already, moving on towards, middle age, 40. We talked at the beginning of this discussion about this wasn't about nostalgia. And if you were born in 1978, the terminal year of the essays that this book covers, it might as well be 1928 to 1938, because the 33-year-old didn't live it. What would you hope that a 33-year-old reading this would take from it? I mean, certainly it's just interesting in and of itself. I mean, you read a history of 70 years ago. That's interesting. But this, somehow the 60s and the 68 to 78 seem to have a lot, it remains dynamic in the life of this country.
Absolutely. Well, that's a great question. And the real takeaway for everybody, whether you're just looking at it as a piece of history or you want to understand why it connects to today, all you have to do is turn on the television and you've got one whole sort of pseudo network that styles itself as fair and balanced. And all it does all day long is fight a culture war. That's what it's doing. And it has to have an enemy. And who is the enemy? There actually is an enemy. It's us. It's all the things and all the people that have been involved in this deep, deep transformation of social values and social expectations that emerged from this panoply of behaviors during that time. So there's a broad sense of social justice, of racial tolerance, of openness to gender and sexuality, of ecological sanity. All of these things come together, sense of the need for labor, some sort of decent work that actually makes the world a better place, not just a world that reproduces capitalism. Those kinds of values are deep in our culture, and there are millions of us who hold them, and we have no political voice, and we have no voice in the media. So we all live in a state of constant isolation. I mean, both of us have had experience in the past with the situationists and the whole notion of the society of the spectacle that speaks to us all day long in one voice and one voice only and denies our own lived experience completely to the point where we doubt ourselves. We wonder, like, how can I feel this way when I'm alone and nobody else feels this way and everybody else says I'm crazy for feeling this way? Well, actually, we probably are a majority. And the fact is, the society has structured itself in such a way through private ownership of the means of communication and every aspect of property in the society that our voices and our lived experience and the values we have are denied. They're in a state of, there's a war against them. And it's a rear guard war trying to stop something that's already well underway.
And this covers a slice of it, an important slice. San Francisco, 1968 to 1978. The book is 10 Years That Shook the City. It's edited by my guest, Chris Carlson, and he did it along with Lisa Ruth Elliott. It's published by City Lights. You can go to citylights.com and find it. Also, my website, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E.com. There'll be a link there as well. Incredible essays in here, including Underground Comics, another one with the San Francisco Bay Area posters during that era. A terrific read. Thanks, Chris Carlson.
Thank you, Peter. It's great to be on with you.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with another guest right after this.
Is it time to replace your home's carpet or flooring? Call Sears Flooring to get shop-at-home convenience you can trust. Sears Flooring brings the showroom to you with a wide range of carpet, tile, hardwood, and laminate. And if you call right now, you'll save 20%. Call for a free in-home consultation at 1-888-491-3939. Sears Flooring has many styles to match your home and your budget. Your new flooring will be precisely installed, and your satisfaction is guaranteed. So call Sears Flooring right now and save 20%. Call 1-888-491-3939. Offer ends soon. Not available in all areas. Installation provided by Sears Authorized Licensed Contractors. License information available upon request. Call Sears Flooring. You'll save 20% if you call now. Call 1-888-491-3939. That's 1-888-491-3939. Sears.
Right now, homes are more affordable than they've been in decades. And Quicken Loans has a mortgage program that will help you buy that perfect home. Call Quicken Loans right now. They can even introduce you to a local real estate agent that can guide you through the process step by step. With more than 25 years of helping American homeowners, Quicken Loans makes the process as easy as possible. With a streamlined approach and proactive updates, they provide you with the certainty you need to search for the home of your dreams. And highly trained Quicken Loans specialists are standing by, ready to help you take advantage of this incredible mortgage opportunity. So give Quicken Loans a call now. Call 888-249-1425. Find out how much home you can afford. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. Nationwide licensing number 3030. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. Call 888-249-1425. That's 888-249-1425.
This is Dan Tullis, and I just called
Joel Clark,
one of Select Quote Insurance Services' term life agents.
Hi, Mr. Tullis.
Joel, how does Select Quote save you money on term life insurance?
Well, buying term life insurance is all about choosing the right company. Let's say you take antidepressants or you smoke. All insurance companies are going to price that differently. We'll impartially shop all the companies we represent to find you the best price.
Can you give me an example?
Sure. I just got a man, 40 years old, who takes blood pressure medication, a $500,000 policy with a highly rated insurance company. Its price, $21 a month.
Call 1-800-928-6929 and see how affordable term life insurance can be. That's 1-800-928-6929. 1-800-928-6929. Or go to selectquote.com. We shop, you save. Get full details on the example policy at selectquote.com/commercials. Your price could vary depending on your health, issuing company, and other factors. Not available in all states.
Our son would go from, "Good morning, Mom," to words you'd never expect to come out of your child's mouth. Our pain came from not knowing what to do. He was diagnosed with paranoid schizophrenia. 5 or 6 years later, he was diagnosed with obsessive compulsive disorder. I think the hardest part of living with someone who has a mental illness is thinking that you're alone, that no one else could understand. NAMI, the National Alliance on Mental Illness, is made up of people who live it every day. We lean on each other and we learn from each other. NAMI doesn't let anyone give up hope. My name is Mary Tadigan, and I can tell you what NAMI has meant for my family. It has meant that we are a family.
1 in 5 adults lives with depression, schizophrenia, anxiety, or other mental illnesses. NAMI provides education and support to these families and individuals. To find a local chapter, go to NAMI.org or call 800-950-NAMI.
How old's the roof on your home? If it's over 15 years old, how much longer will it last before the leaks begin? Think about the damage. Then think about this. If it's time for a new roof, call Sears to get your roofing done right. And if you call Sears right now, you'll save $500. Just call 1-877-938-1414. Sears licensed fully insured contractors install a variety of shingles and styles that are built for long-lasting performance. And you'll save $500 if you call now. So call Sears for a free in-home consultation. 1-877-938-1414. Hurry. Offer ends soon. Not available in all states. Installation provided by Sears authorized licensed contractors. License information available upon request. So if you need a new roof, call Sears Roofing. Call right now and save $500. Call 1-877-938-1414. That's 1-877-938-1414. Sears.
Now, Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werby here with you. Hey, I'm looking at my little pocket edition of the Constitution and the First Amendment. When people think of the First Amendment, the first thing they think about is freedom of speech, freedom of assembly, freedom of press, all the rights that we should have as citizens. But it's rare that people realize that the first clause in there, it says that Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion, and then continues, or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. So concerned were the founding fathers of what state-designated religions did to the body politic. And yet we've seen the intermingling of religion and the political state to a high degree. There's always huge debates. Religious conservatives say that liberals are trying to kick religion out of the public square. On the other side, we say that religion should be a private matter and not be intertwined with government. Well, there's been a number of very important court cases, and probably maybe the first one comes to mind is the No Prayer in School one in the early 1960s with Madeleine Murray O'Hare. But there was another one before that, and it's chronicled in a brand-new one-hour Peabody and Emmy Award-winning documentary that tells this story of a woman's battle to really make that First Amendment come alive. It's The Lord Is Not on Trial Here Today. And it is produced and directed by Jay Rubenstein with narration by former MASH television star David Ogden Stiers. And it recounts, well, let's do this. Let's bring in the man who made this all happen, Jay Rubenstein. He's on the road in Northern California. Jay, thanks for joining me on the Peter Werby Show.
Sure, thanks for inviting me. I should correct you. It's Rosenstein, not Rubenstein.
Oh, you know what? I'm sorry.
That's okay.
I'm mixing you up with a friend of mine.
That's not a problem, as long as it's a friend.
All right. Jay Rosenstein. Yeah, that's very important. Yeah, it is. Boy, I hadn't even thought of that. But okay. Thank you for the correction.
Sure.
If we edited this, I would edit it out, but no need. All right, Jay Rosenstein, tell me the film, the genesis of it. This is a fairly obscure case that I know through the Freedom From Religion Foundation, but how did you tumble on it?
Well, I tumbled on it because I live in Champaign, Illinois, and this case was born in Champaign, Illinois. And so it's always sort of been part of the story. The case has been part of the sort of folklore of Champaign, Illinois. And I just knew very vaguely that sometime in the 1940s there had been some sort of Supreme Court case. And I really didn't know any other details other than the woman who had done it was Vashti McCollum. And I didn't even know if she was still alive, for that matter. So, I became interested in finding out more about the story, and I actually just picked up the phone book and looked under McCollum, and her name was listed, and I dialed up the number, and there she was. So that was the first time I even realized she was still alive.
Well, and this is recently. How old is she? Must be in her, like, 80s or 90s.
Yeah, well, she died in 2006, and so she died at age 93. So she was about 91 or 92 when I first contacted her. So, yes, she was definitely getting up there in age.
Well, tell us Vashti McCollum's story and how the importance of it.
Sure. Well, first, let me tell you the importance of it first, because, as you said, it's a very obscure case, and yet it's unbelievably historically important in terms of the history of the United States and the history of the Supreme Court and the First Amendment in the United States. So the case represents a lot of firsts. And the first being, this is the first case where the Supreme Court ever stopped a religious activity from taking place in a public school. So you mentioned, for instance, the school prayer case that happened in the early 1960s, which is a lot better known than the McCollum case. But the McCollum case is the very first time that the court steps in and starts this idea of separation of church and state in public school. And in fact, it is the case where that phrase essentially gets constitutionalized by the court. So lately there's been a lot of sort of debate about the fact that the exact wording, those exact words, the phrase separation of church and state, don't appear in the text of the Constitution. And that's true, they don't. But they become constitutionalized in the ruling in this case of McCollum versus Board of Education. It's also the first case where the Supreme Court rules that the First Amendment actually applies to bodies of state government, not just the federal government. As you mentioned, it starts off with the phrase, Congress shall make no law, and Congress, of course, is the federal government. And this is the case where the first case that's won where the court applies that to bodies of state government. And in this case, it's the school board, because public school boards are part of state government. So that's the importance of the case, generally. As far as Mrs. McCollum is concerned, I'll try to be very brief about the story. But in the 1940s, it was very common to have religion instruction classes in public schools. And generally, they were almost exclusively Protestant instructional classes. And so when these classes finally came to Champaign and hit her older son, who was in fourth grade at the time, she objected to it. She basically thought that that religion shouldn't be taught in public schools, that it was a matter for the churches, and of course there's different kids of different religions. So she didn't allow her son to participate in this class. And what would happen is the religion teacher would come into the public school and give the class right there during school hours. And so since her son was not allowed to be in the class, they had to figure out what to do with him. So they had to take him out and put him somewhere, and eventually they put him out in the hall where they put kids who were behavior problems. And that caused him to be hugely ostracized, picked on, abused, etc. And essentially she got angry and decided to sue the school board, and that begins the whole process.
Well, it's interesting that you actually received an award, the film did, the Silver Gavel Award from the American Bar Association, which says it was the best nonfiction television program about law and legal issues in 2011. So it may be obscure, but it obviously is a good documentary. It'll be available on PBS stations, and you can check your local station here in Detroit for the exact date and time, or around the country if you're listening elsewhere. You can also go to Jay Rosenstein's website, thelordisnotontrial.com. Tell us some, what's the meaning of the title?
The meaning of the title actually comes from something that happened during the trial. And so it's the first day of the trial, which is taking place in circuit court in Champaign, Illinois. And I should say this trial was very much a huge media circus of the time. This is 1945. And many in the press were comparing it to the famous Scopes trial, the Monkey trial. So media from all over the country were covering this, and it was a big circus. But the first day, apparently, of the trial, apparently a man, a spectator, came walking into the courtroom carrying a Bible under his arm. And he walked up to one of the attorneys and said, "I've come here to testify for the Lord." And the attorneys turned to him and said, "I'm sorry, sir, but the Lord is not on trial here today." And so that's the genesis of the title. But I also want to mention that Vashti's middle son, Dan McCollum, wrote a book with also a very similar title. He has a book out called The Lord Was Not on Trial. And also I should mention, for people who are interested in learning more about the case, I would also recommend his book as well.
And Jim McCollum, the child in question, who is now an older adult, is still active in the movement to keep church and state separate. And in fact, I was just looking online, and he is at this Lake Hypatia observance that the Freedom From Religion Foundation carries out every day. Did you have what they say, that kind of that phrase, a dog in the fight? I mean, did you want to make like an atheist film? Was that your intent in this regard?
Well, no. I would say that to some degree I do a bit have a dog in the fight, and the reason why is because I have two children who go to public school who are Jewish, which means they're part of a religious minority. And so I feel very strongly that it's destructive for both the government and for religion to be intermingling the two. So I certainly don't want my kids to have to go to school and be forced to take courses or be indoctrinated in some other religion. I feel as a parent that that's my role. It's not the government's role to tell them how to pray and what religion, but it's mine. So, you know, in that way, I would say, like any other citizen who has children in public school, you know, I do have a dog in the fight. But you mentioned the Silver Gavel Award that I won, and I'm extremely proud of that because it says that I got the legal stuff right, and that this is not an activist film and it's not pushing an agenda, but rather it's a film that really educates people about not just this story, but just all these concepts, separation of church and state and the First Amendment and the religion clauses in the First Amendment. And so the American Bar Association essentially has put their seal of approval on it, and I'm really very proud of that.
You should be. Jay Rosenstein, you're talking about events that happened almost 70 years ago, pardon me, in the Lord Is Not on Trial here today. What constitutes the film in terms of who are you able to talk to? Is Jim McCollum the son of Vashti McCollum, who sued the school district so her son wouldn't get religious instruction? Is he in it?
Oh, yes. I was able to interview Vashti McCollum and Jim and Dan, who's the middle son, and some other people, a few of whom were children who were involved in the trial at the time. You know, one of the most difficult things was, of course, as you mentioned, it happened a long time ago. And unfortunately, when I started doing the film, Vashti was the only adult who had been one of the primary people in the case who was still alive. So in other words, all the other major players had died, and the only other people who were alive who participated in the trial had been children at the time, like her son Jim, who was 11 years old at the time. So really it's Vashti herself that I think provides the primary voice in the film, and I'm so happy that I got a chance to spend some extended time with her before she passed away.
And there, in the community itself, she received incredible negative response from many community members, right?
Yes, and it wasn't just in the community she lived in, which is Champaign, Illinois. You know, the McCollum family really became the enemies of, you know, mainstream organized religion in the United States. And she really became, you know, public enemy number one, particularly of, you know, sort of the mainstream national Christian organizations who very much characterized this trial as a battle between atheism and Christianity. And Vashti McCollum very much was opposed to that idea. She never felt that it was a battle of atheism against Christianity. It was simply a battle over the Constitution and what the First Amendment really means. So, locally in the community, yes, the family was totally ostracized. Her husband was working as a professor at the state university, and immediately, members of the legislature called and tried to have him fired. Huh. The house was vandalized. Their cat was lynched. You know, they suffered all kinds of abuse, you know, tons of hate mail and phone calls, you know, hang up phone calls and those kind of things. And the family really just pulled together and stood strong and were able to endure this, although Jim, the oldest son who the case was built around, things were so bad for him that they had to send him away.
Wow.
And he got sent to New York to live with his grandparents to finish out school because he was taking such abuse he couldn't stay there anymore.
And they were getting, the family, the Vashti family, was getting 200 letters a day, and she was called a communist, and it was...
Right.
Okay, go ahead.
I was just going to say, and you know, at this time period in American history, you know, it's just on the cusp of where, you know, being labeled a communist is perhaps the worst thing you can be called at the time, because we know beginning in the late 40s and then on into the early 50s, what happens to people in America if you're labeled a communist. And, you know, we're on the cusp of, you know, all the McCarthy hearings and all those other things. And people at that time were very much equating being an atheist with being a communist. So in other words, if you didn't believe in God, you didn't go to church, you were an atheist, then you must be a communist.
Hmm. Deru, Rosenstein, tell us the legal voyage of this. So it began just in a circuit court.
Correct.
And how did it progress through the state and then into the federal court system?
Sure. Well, you know, the trial took place in the circuit court, and it was heard before a three-judge panel, which was very unusual, and the legal scholars who were involved in the helping me vet the story to this day are still very stumped by the fact that two additional judges were pulled in. But the main judge in the case, his name is Frank B. Leonard, actually had a huge conflict of interest. He actually had previously been an attorney for the school board, who were now essentially being sued. So he probably should have recused himself, although I don't think it would have changed the outcome one bit, because she was going up against such an ingrained community standard. So she lost at the circuit court level and appealed to the Illinois Supreme Court and went to the oral arguments at the Supreme Court hearing and watched as the justices were dozing off during the arguments. They weren't even paying attention. And so she knew right then she was going to lose at that court, and she did. She lost at the appeal at the Illinois Supreme Court. And so all that was left was the U.S. Supreme Court, and they appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court. And I don't know how many people are aware of this, but the U.S. Supreme Court agrees to hear a very, very small number of cases. So just the fact that you appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court does not guarantee they'll even take your case.
And it would be, I mean, they're selective oftentimes politically. So they knew they were taking a social and political risk by accepting this case.
Absolutely. And so they accepted the case, and she eventually won an 8-1 decision at the Supreme Court level.
So it was pretty clear to the justices, when you have that almost unanimous vote, that the religious instruction in public school was unconstitutional, did not meet the standards of the First Amendment, which says Congress shall establish no religion. Well, but then they were still left with prayers in school, right? And that went on. So
you know, it's interesting. If you look at the there's three decisions by the Supreme Court around this issue of religion and public school that come very close together. And there's really no consistency between the three, which is very unusual. The first case that hit was right before the McCollum case, and this is actually the most famous case of the group. And I don't understand why, because the outcome is the plaintiff lost. But it's called the Everson case, or the Everson bus case. And in that case, taxpayer money was used to bus children to religious schools. And the court ruled in a 5-4 decision that that was acceptable. Although, in their opinion, they first used this phrase, separation of church and state. So they used all this rhetoric about there having to be this separation of church and state, and yet they voted against the case. Then, you know, quickly that was followed by the McCollum case, which, as I mentioned earlier in the program, became the first case that is won, and it's won by a resounding vote, that this idea of separation of church and state does belong essentially in the Constitution, and that's how the justices are going to interpret the First Amendment. But then, just a few years later, there was another case that was very similar to the McCollum case. The only difference was, instead of there being a religion class being given during school hours in the school building. They actually took the kids out of the school building and brought them somewhere else for the religion class. And then in that case, the justices ruled that was acceptable. So you have these three decisions in a row, which in many ways kind of bounce back and forth between, you know, feeling that there has to be strong separation versus there shouldn't. So, you know, it's very confusing.
Well, I should say that your film, The Lord, is not on trial, and that is the website as well, if you just put .com after it, doesn't really address, and I'm sure it didn't address itself before the justices at the time, whether or not religious instruction was good or bad, or whether it had a good effect or a negative effect on students, but just under our Constitution does not belong in the public sphere.
Well, correct. And you know, let me say two things. First of all, yes, and the issue is not even so much whether religion is good or bad. That's not the issue in the Constitution. The issue is that the government has to treat all religions and non-religion equally. So that's really the key. So when you give religious instruction in school or being given by any body of government, it's not possible to do that in a way that treats every single religion there is equally and non-religion equally. So the issue always comes up. The problem is that you're essentially promoting or playing favorites to a certain religion. But you know, I do have an issue with this idea of the public square, and it's a phrase that's used a lot, and you used it, and I hear that a lot,
sure.
This idea that we're kicking God out of the public square. And that's absolutely false. What the First Amendment is about is it's about government institutions, not the public square. And what I mean by that is, you know, you walk around, drive down any street in America, literally, and this is, you know, public property, and you see symbols and expressions of religion everywhere, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you can freely go into a public park and hold a religious service if you want. Nobody will stop you as long as you're following the rules of how the park is used for other events. So religion is everywhere in the public square. It's on our currency. You can't get away from it. The issue is that it has to do with government institutions, that government institutions can't be promoting a certain religion. But as far as it being in public, it's everywhere in public.
My guest is Jay Rosenstein. He is the producer and director of the documentary The Lord Is Not on Trial. And you can go to thelordisnotontrial.com. Also be a link on my site, peterwerbe.com as well, W-E-R-B-E. When you interviewed the plaintiff who said her son should not be receiving religious education in a public school, and finally they won, but she received just such terrible treatment throughout the country and from her neighbors. How did she evaluate it all after it was finished?
Well, you know, after it was finished, you know, she said something. She says it in the film, and her son said, you know, she said this her whole life, this very same line, which is just, I knew I was right. There was no question in my mind. And so she believed that from the first day, and she, you know, she went to her grave fully believing that she was right, that what was happening was a violation of the Constitution. And even though her taking that stand was very unpopular at the time, she knew that she was right, and the court sort of confirmed that to her.
Did she stay in that city?
You know, she did for a long time, and then later moved to Arkansas, and then moved back to Champaign, Illinois. So she was living in Champaign when she died. Yes. And so things actually, fairly quickly after the trial was over, or after the Supreme Court decision was over, things actually kind of went back to normal in a way in terms of their treatment by the community. You know, there were always some people who harbored some resentments and such, but as time went by, those became less and less. And one of the great ironies of this whole story, I think, is that, you know, her middle son, Dan, who, as part of the family, was completely ostracized by this town, Champaign, Illinois. As an adult, he actually got elected mayor of Champaign, Illinois, and served three terms as mayor, and is still the official historian of Champaign, Illinois. So in a way, the family kind of got their revenge, and eventually were able to be totally accepted by the city, and that's how things are now.
This is an incredible story, and yet any challenge of religion is often, as we just hinted at a little earlier, any challenge to religion's role in public life is taken by some as being anti-religion, and you assured us it was not, but more about the Constitution. That PBS is willing to put it out there. We often talk about PBS not willing, being less and less willing to take any chances. Was this a chance? I mean, have they gotten any negative criticism about your film?
None that I know of.
Well, good. I shouldn't suggest. Maybe I shouldn't have even. I thought you were going to say,
And that's okay. But, again, I think, when you see the film, it's a historically accurate film, and I take very, great pride in trying to make it as factually precise as I possibly could. And although it's told primarily from the point of view of the family who filed the case, the McCollums, and what they went through, it's not a film that's particularly pushing an agenda, so to speak. This is what happened, and this is how the McCollum family experienced it. And, the film does not argue the rightness or the wrongness of the Supreme Court decision. And I set out originally not to do that. The fact is that the decision has been made, and it is what it is. And no arguing about it today will change the fact that the decision in the McCollum case is 8-1 for Vashti McCollum.
Well, I want to thank you so much, Jay Rosenstein. The documentary is The Lord Is Not on Trial Here Today. It's a Peabody and Emmy Award-winning documentary and tells the story of Vashti McCollum, who says didn't want her son to have religious instruction in public school. It is being shown on PBS. You can check your local station for exact date and time. And you can go to thelordisnotontrial.com, where the DVD of it is available as well. And it'll be a link on my website if you missed all of this. Peter Werbe, WERBE.com. Jay Rosenstein, thanks for being my guest.
Oh, thanks so much, Peter. Appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to Night Call on 101 WRIF. The views expressed on the program are not necessarily those of the staff, management, or ownership of WRIF Radio. Now, stay tuned for more Riff Rock on 101 WRIF Detroit.
When it's raining hard outside, can your roof still keep out the leaks inside? If it's time for a new roof, get your roofing installed the right way with Sears. Call Sears for a free in-home consultation at 1-877-938-1414. You can save $500 if you call right now. Sears licensed fully insured contractors can get your roofing job done right. Sears has a variety of shingles and styles that are built for long-lasting performance, and you'll save $500 if you call now. So for roofing done right, call Sears for a free in-home consultation at 1-877-938-1414. Hurry, offer ends soon. Not available in all states. Installation provided by Sears authorized licensed contractors. License information available upon request. That's Sears Roofing. Call right now and save $500. Call 1-877-938-1414. That's 1-877-938-1414. Sears.
Rates, policy forms, and availability vary by state. Did you know that life insurance rates are near record lows? If you own life insurance or are thinking of buying any, why spend more than you have to? I'm Byron Udell, founder of AccuQuote. Since 1986, we've helped hundreds of thousands of people just like you save a fortune on their life insurance. Here's how we do it. We monitor the products offered by dozens of the most well-respected brand-name life insurance companies you trust so that you get the lowest rates. For example, a healthy 40-year-old can buy $500,000 of 10-year level term for less than $21 a month. 20 and 30-year rates are also available. And don't forget to ask us about the new term life plans that guarantee your money back even if you don't die. Take 5 minutes and call AccuQuote for your free quote at 800-654-2075. Find out how much you can save on your life insurance. Call AccuQuote today at 800-654-2075. That's 800-654-2075.
One little fish oil pill. You know this powerful little pill is great for your heart, that it's great for your joints. It even has powerful benefits for your skin and brain function. But the fish oils of today are sadly incomplete because they don't contain the super antioxidant power of clinically proven krill oil that can increase joint comfort by 28% in just 7 days. Until now. Introducing the free bottle giveaway of Krill Omega 3 from Purity Products, our most powerful fish oil formula ever. The only thing our advanced Krill Omega 3 fish oil is missing is the price. Because right now, we're offering anyone a full-size bottle of our krill oil as part of a nationwide free trial. Just call 1-800-950-5868. To request yours, you can't go to stores. The only way to get your free bottle is to go to the phone. The number is 1-800-950-5868. Call now and claim your bottle absolutely free. 1-800-950-5868. That's 1-800-950-5868.
Now's the time.
Now's the time to make a difference.
Now's the time to do what's right.
To help a family.
Now's the time to volunteer.
To make a commitment.
To make new friends.
To make dreams come true.
To help a child.
Now's the time to help Habitat for Humanity build hope and change lives.